This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
Two big decisions handed down by the Supreme Court yesterday affecting pension policy and truck traffic. In the first case, two Illinois men who worked construction jobs and then retired at the age of 39 will have their pensions restored to their full amounts. The Central Laborers' Pension Fund docked them benefits after the two had gone back to work. The justices did leave the door open for pension funds to adopt restrictions against so-called double-dipping in the future, though, so long as the workers in the fund know about the policy when they join it. The second case clears the way for Mexican truck traffic to travel unimpeded on U.S. highways as required by the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. Various environmental and union groups had sued to block the move, citing clean air and vehicle safety concerns, but the Supreme Court said it's not the federal government's job to consider such factors when following free trade obligations.
Instead of passing an extension for unemployment benefits, a new bill approved by the House on Thursday seeks to set up so-called reemployment accounts. Unemployed workers could receive up to $3,000 in a personal account for use in getting a job. However, the exact amount will be up to each state to determine, and to be eligible, a person must be able to prove they are likely to exhaust their unemployment benefits.
Although independent trade unions are currently illegal in Iraq under the law of the occupying authorities, the Federation of Workers' Councils and Unions in Iraq continues to work on a draft labor law to be implemented following the planned restoration of sovereignty at the end of June. And it's setting its sights high, a maximum 6-hour working day or 30-hour work week, retirement at age 55, double pay for working nighttime hours, and a minimum 36 days of vacation per year are just some of the provisions in the draft legislation.
10,000 striking home health care workers in New York City declared a partial victory on Monday when their union, the Service Employees International Local 1199, reached a tentative new contract. Home health care workers' average pay is $7 per hour, but under the terms of the new agreement, their wages will increase to $10 per hour in the next 3 years. However, the tentative settlement only covers half of the total 23,000 striking health care workers throughout the city. The other half will remain on strike through Wednesday.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The nation's unemployment rate for May remained steady at 5.6%, even though there were 250,000 new jobs generated last month, and the number of unemployed people counted by the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics actually rose by 39,000. The Economic Policy Institute qualifies this as a solid job market recovery, but notes it takes the average American looking for a job 5 months now to find success.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Have you visited 100fires.com lately? If not, then you're missing out on thousands of books for a better world. Books about how you can make a difference, about the rights of workers, creating more livable communities, and about how we can stop large corporations from destroying our democracy. 100fires.com offers secure ordering, full searchability, gift certificates, and much, much more. That's 100fires.com. Books for a better world.
Wow, that White House spin machine is in full twirl over the U.S. torture scandals in Iraq. Not to worry, those disgusting acts were just the work of a half dozen low-level grunts who should have known better. Where's the machine, now in nuclear-powered perpetual motion? No one in command, much less at the Pentagon or White House, had a clue that this was happening, and it's contrary to our official policy against any abuse of any prisoners, they spin. And look over there, the White House shrieks. We're prosecuting those bad soldiers to the hilt. So see, the system works, and that's the end of the story, so let's move on. But wait, Rumsfeld knew about the torture last year, and he personally told George W. about it in January. They not only had a clue, they had full detailed reports from the Army itself and from the Red Cross. Yet they kept it hush-hush, apparently not feeling disgust until the torture became public. As far as official policy is concerned, look at what has just surfaced. A series of 2001 and 2002 internal memos from Bush's Justice Department and from his top White House lawyer claiming that the U.S. did not have to comply with the Geneva Conventions and other international bans on prisoner abuse. White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez, who seems to think that his job amounts to finding a rationalization for anything the Bushites want to do, wrote in a 2002 memo to George that the war on terrorism, quote, in my judgment, renders obsolete Geneva's strict limitation on questioning of enemy prisoners. This is Jim Hightower saying, obsolete? Fashions can become obsolete. Machines get obsolete too, but fundamental morals and guidelines for humane conduct cannot, especially not on some partisan lawyer's whim. But there it is in writing, a policy sanctioning abuse and even torture written on White House stationery. It turns out that those grunts in Iraq were acting within a legal framework devised by the Bushites themselves.
I am Gunnery Sergeant R. Lee Ermey, United States Marine Corps. While our armed forces defend our freedom, their families shoulder household duties and emergencies alone. To help, the veterans of foreign wars and Vermont American brand Bits and Blades have created the Unmet Needs Program.
Rufus Forrest here, VFW Senior Administrator. Please support the Unmet Needs Program by purchasing Vermont American Bits and Blades. A portion of each purchase goes to help families.
Visit unmetneeds.com and buy Vermont American brand Bits and Blades. Thank you and Semper Fi. Hoorah!
Hello from Athens, Greece. Leave it to Econo Lodge and Roadway Inn Hotels to create the Wake Up a Winner sweepstakes. Go to choicehotels.com to learn how to enter, and you can win a trip to the big events in Athens. To book, call 800-4-CHOICE or go to choicehotels.com. Choice Hotels. We'll see you there.
No purchase necessary. Open to legal U.S. residents 18 and older. Void where prohibited. Promotion runs June 7th through August 29th, 2004. For official rules and how to enter without purchase, visit choicehotels.com.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border on terrestrial radio stations, on cable radio network, on Sirius satellite, on radiopower.org, archives at whiterosesociety.org. Boy, apparently, I was just too subtle. You know, some people just don't. I have to think that they weren't paying attention. I thought the email that I've gotten in the last 24 hours has ranged from, I've got a few, for example, here's one. This is from a woman named Barbara. She says, Tom, I loved your distinction between Reagan, the head of state, versus head of government. Very true. Last night, C-SPAN had Reagan's 1992 RNC convention speech, and I couldn't help but admire his determination and optimism. Especially in the face of the oncoming Alzheimer's, which seemed evident at that time. It is so true that he gave us a forward-looking positive vision, unlike the current president, such a contrast. So even though I hated most of his policies at the time, and hate them now even more, that I understand them better, I admire the man. Also that he came from a poor background, so unlike the Silver Spoon Bushes. This is from Barbara. Now that was one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum, you know, a number of people, of course, forwarded to me Greg Palast's screed. And you know, one person even suggested that I should die. So let me just recap very quickly for those of you who don't understand. In most nations, the functions of head of government and head of state and head of state are separated. And the Nation magazine And I'm not sure you can find this in Common Dreams. I know it's on TomPaine.com right now. You can find a link to it. Has a brilliant article about this, making the same point that I made yesterday. That the function of head of state is a figurehead function. The Queen of England is the head of state. Nobody cares about her politics. The question is, does she do a good job of representing the dignitary functions, as it were? Does she alienate foreign leaders, or does she embrace them? Does she represent her nation well? Does she have a decent personality? And you know, and as I said, I thought as head of state, Ronald Reagan wasn't terribly bad. In fact, I thought he was better than many presidents that we've had. As head of government, however, head of government. Now, see, in England, the head of government is not the Queen. She doesn't make the decisions. The head of government is Tony Blair. He's the prime minister. And as head of government, Reagan was an unmitigated disaster. More people in his administration were indicted and convicted than any in the history of the United States. He himself probably could have been, certainly could have been, not only indicted, but impeached in the House and the Senate for high crimes and misdemeanors. It was incredibly corrupt, his administration. He oversaw the beginning of the dismantling of the American middle class. Now, you know, I have to acknowledge, I believe he was actually a true believer in the conservative philosophy. That doesn't make it any less toxic. The man was incredibly destructive to America and the world in many regards. And yet, because I dared to say that I thought he made a decent head of state while he was a lousy head of government, I got people just going ballistic on me. Well, I will say it again. I stand by it. I stand by it. And here's the kicker. The Democrats need to learn this. You know, this was the big problem of Mike Dukakis, frankly. People looked at him and said, well, he might be a very good technocrat, he might be a very good bureaucrat, but, you know, in other words, he would be a good head of government. But as head of state, he doesn't quite look presidential. And this is where I think, you know, actually John Kerry has a significant edge over George W. Bush, because George W. Bush is a lousy head of state. He's a terrible head of government also, for those of us who disagree with his policies. He's very effective as head of government for those who do agree with his policies. He's handed trillions of dollars of our money and our children's and our grandchildren's money to his very wealthy donors. He's destroyed the environment. He's, you know, on and on and on. I mean, you know, this is, I don't need to read you the list. It just seems to never end. Continuing Reagan's policy of basically deconstructing the New Deal in the Great Society, particularly the New Deal. But I think that John Kerry could actually be as great a head of state that is perceived by the average person who doesn't much pay attention to policy, who doesn't pay so much attention to the head of government functions, and perceived by the world as somebody who admirably and honorably represents the United States. And yeah, Reagan in his later years said some mighty stupid things. I, you know, frankly, a friend of mine was the court reporter who deposed him while he was still in office, a year before he left office. A court reporter, one of several. In the Iran-Contra scandal, where 134 times he said, I don't remember. And I had dinner with her and her husband that night in Los Angeles. And I remember her telling me, there's nobody there. This guy is gone. He is gone. I don't know if he was on drugs. I don't know if he has senile dementia. But he is gone. I mean, he didn't remember the names of people who he was introduced to in the room. He didn't remember what day of the week it was on some occasions. He was gone. And he was still president of the United States his last year. So his last couple of years, I think, you know, were basically George Bush was running the country. But anyhow, so I just wanted to put that out one more. Stir the pot one more time. Get a little more hate mail here. How many members of the Bush administration are needed to replace a light bulb? one of the great questions of our day. The answer? 7. 1 to deny that a light bulb needs to be replaced. 1 to attack and question the patriotism of anyone who has questions about the light bulb. 1 to blame Bill Clinton for the need of a new light bulb. 1 to invade the invasion of a 1 to arrange the invasion of a country rumored to have a secret stock of light bulbs. 1 to get together with Vice President Cheney to figure out how to pay Halliburton Industries $1 million for a light bulb. 1 to arrange a photo op session showing Bush changing the light bulb while dressed in a flight suit, well stuffed with a sock, and wrapped in an American flag. And 7, finally, 1 to explain the Bush difference between screwing a light bulb and screwing the country. Speaking of which, the Republicans lost a round. I don't know if you saw this. Some of the Supreme Court decisions are starting to come out now. And I think this is important, useful. You know, we need to keep track of this stuff. The Supreme Court, ever since John Marshall's decision in 1802 in the Mabry versus Madison case, in which he took upon himself and the Supreme Court the power to strike down laws passed by the elected representatives of we the people, which the Constitution doesn't give the Supreme Court, but which it has held since 1802, Mabry versus Madison. Thomas Jefferson was president at the time. He went nuts. He said, if this decision's allowed to stand, the Constitution has become a thing of wax. Anyhow, here we have the Supreme Court. Two rulings today that I want to share with you. The first, in Colorado, the Republicans have been trying to do what they did in Texas, which is, gerrymander. Move districts around, move congressional districts around so that, we'll avoid this street, and we'll go to that street, and we'll move around to this block, and blah 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 blah, so that the districts that the Republicans hold are much safer, and the districts which the Democrats hold are much more fragile. Now, the Constitution says that at every year ending with a zero, that is every 10 years, there is to be a census, and once the census is taken, the constitutional districts should be redrawn to reflect the census. In other words, the more people there are in a particular place, the more people who are, doing whatever they're doing, the more people who are living wherever they're living, the more people there are, the more representatives in the House of Representatives you have. Here in Vermont, we have 1. What does New York have? A dozen? I don't know. But big states have lots. Little states have few. Based on population, every 10 years, some states actually lose a few representatives. Other states actually gain a few representatives. By the way, our number is 1-866-889-8894. And Adam, if you want me to take that call from Holly, you're going to have to put her on hold. There you go. Okay. Colorado had been trying to do this, Colorado Republicans, and they lost in the Supreme Court of Colorado. So they took it to the federal Supreme Court. And two interesting things about this. The federal Supreme Court agreed, basically. They chose not to hear the ruling, which is the same thing as agreeing with the lower court. However, here's the caveat. In other words, the Republicans don't get to change the rules every single year. They have to wait every 10 years. Now, it's interesting to see if this will have any effect on Texas. I frankly doubt it. I think that's a done deal. But the other thing that I thought was interesting was that Chief Justice William Rehnquist, Justices Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas wrote separately to say that the court was wrong to not hear the case. I mean, these guys are so partisan, they give partisan a bad name. Holly in Santa Fe, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number if you'd like to be on the program. Hey, Holly, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm trying to understand what you're saying about Reagan, and I think I do. But I think what concerns me is there seems to be something particularly insidious about someone who is so charming and so seductive that he wins the admiration and trust of the very people he's raping.
I absolutely agree.
And you know, people say, well, he didn't understand that. He had the best of intentions, and All I can see is the face of my junior high teacher, Miss Lewandowski, who told me on the morning when I said I did my homework, but I forgot it, that the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Yeah. No, I agree with you.
You can't let him off the hook. And even now, in death, the man is being lifted up and admired.
Yeah, well, that'll happen for a little while. I mean, it always does. But the point that I was making was not that he did good as head of state, but that he was competent at it. George W. Bush is incompetent at it. Jimmy Carter was only reasonably competent at it. And I think that if the Democrats want to start winning presidential elections, they have to get people who have that level of competence, the ability to project enthusiasm, optimism, and, you know, hopefully attached to the right policies. Does that make sense, Holly?
Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. 20 minutes past the hour. No, by no means do I mean to say that I think Ronald Reagan was a great president or even a good president. He was a miserable failure as a president, but he was very competent as a head of state. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
Pine River, Michigan, where the abandoned Velsicol plant leaks cancer-causing chemicals into the water. It's a danger neighbors will be living with for years to come. The Bush administration says polluters no longer have to pay to clean up the mess they leave behind. Taxpayers do. That means less money, fewer cleanups, and more families left at risk. Mr. President, there is a better way. Make polluters pay. Protect our kids and communities.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Research from the Medical College of Wisconsin highlights a workplace ailment related to people who work with vibrating machinery for long periods of time. It has symptoms common to repetitive stress injuries, first tingling and mild discomfort, then pain and numbness. The research seems to suggest constant exposure to vibration affects blood flow throughout the extremities, which can starve nerves of an adequate blood supply. Workplace light and sound levels are commonly regulated, but vibration amounts are not.
Do you want to find out what the invasion of Iraq was really about? Read the new illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Once you've read We the People, you'll understand why conservatives are trying to bankrupt government and how perpetual war is used as a political strategy in the United States. You'll learn how our votes are in danger and what we must do about it. You'll discover why the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 matter today. populist watchdog and national radio commentator Jim Hightower had this to say about We the People.
Not only does this book tell you what's really going on, but it even draws you a picture of it. Read, learn, and act.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. A compelling story of how a government by and for the people has been replaced by corporate domination. Fully illustrated by Neil Cohn, We the People issues a call to action in a most entertaining way. Available in bookstores everywhere.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Back 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. 866-889-8894. Our telephone number. Chris in New Mexico is on the line. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Oh, not much. Kudos for the bumper music lately. That's just great.
Well, thank you. Brad Walrod is responsible for most of that, and he does a great job.
Oh, thank him. Did you hear Joe Biden threaten John Ashcroft with contempt of Congress?
No.
Yes.
No, what happened? Tell me about
it. That was the news on the top of the hour. Apparently, Ashcroft is refusing to turn over a briefing memo that was given to Bush outlining the possibilities of torture used on Islamic terrorist suspects. And Ashcroft pointedly said, "I'm not claiming executive privilege," because apparently Kennedy asked him if that was his claim, why he wasn't turning it over. And Ashcroft said, "No, I'm not claiming anything. I'm just not turning it over." And Biden said, "Well, then that's contempt of Congress, because you should know you have to have a reason for not answering our questions." That was on the news at the top of the last hour.
Oh, that's great. I did a piece yesterday on that whole thing. You know, the White House lawyers coming up with all these contorted reasons. You know, why? Yeah. Trump. Torture is okay if we do it, you know, especially if we do it at Guantanamo. Right. Actually, the conclusion they came to was that if we did torture outside of Guantanamo Bay, we'd be in trouble. But if we did it in Guantanamo Bay, and the doctrine that the president is the only person in America who actually runs Guantanamo Bay, and what he says goes, and there is no constitution and there is no law, he's simply king there. Then we could torture people. He could torture people. He could authorize the torture of people in Guantanamo Bay. But if we tried to do it at Abu Ghraib or places like that, then you would have the problem of various international conventions.
Geneva.
Yeah, the Geneva Conventions. Thank you very much.
I just wanted to know. I mean, has that ever happened? Can you? I'm sure you can constitutionally hold anybody in contempt of Congress, including
sure.
the Attorney General, but I just thought it was really interesting, and maybe you could look it up and see what the whole text was, because it was interesting to listen to.
I'll track it down. That does sound interesting, Chris. Thanks for the tip. I appreciate it. And yes, Congress actually can pretty much hold anybody in contempt of Congress. You know, it may not stick, but you know, they can do it. Interesting. Okay, here's the second Supreme Court decision that happened that I thought was interesting. The Bush administration, according to the Supreme Court, these are two rulings that just came out yesterday, can allow tens of thousands of Mexican trucks on U.S. highways without worrying about their environmental effects. Now, up until this Supreme Court decision, if trucks came in from Mexico, they were not allowed to go, say it had a bunch of refrigerators that were made in Mexico that were destined for, you know, Grand Rapids, Michigan. The truck would have to go over the border and then stop, you know, at a certain point, 10, 20, 30 miles down the road, and offload their cargo onto an American truck. In part, you know, the labor unions, of course, the Teamsters were in favor of this because it, you know, American jobs. And the larger argument was made that most Mexican trucks are these 10, 20, 30-year-old diesel things with a completely different set of emission standards, and that they're going to make our air terrible. I mean, you know, we know now that the particulate emission from diesel exhaust causes cancer, among other things. It's among the most toxic of all the things that can come out of an internal combustion engine. And this moratorium has gone back to 1982. In 2002, George Bush said, well, you know, I have no problem with Mexican trucks coming into America and doing whatever they want. And this, by the way, there's 4.5 million of these things a year to make the border crossings. Well, the president prevailed. The president prevailed. And now Mexican trucks can come across the border and go anywhere they want. We don't need to use American trucks, American employees. It's like offshoring, insourcing something. I mean, you know, come up with a word for it. It's bizarre. It's the wonderful new world of free trade. It helps the multinational corporations. Screw the environment. Forget about the American worker. Yes, my friend, it's the Bush way. 29 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about The Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
Two big decisions handed down by the Supreme Court yesterday affecting pension policy and truck traffic. In the first case, two Illinois men who worked construction jobs and then retired at the age of 39 will have their pensions restored to their full amounts. The Central Laborers Pension Fund docked them benefits after the two had gone back to work. The justices did leave the door open for pension funds to adopt restrictions against so-called double-dipping in the future, though, so long as the workers in the fund know about the policy when they join it. The second case clears the way for Mexican truck traffic to travel unimpeded on U.S. highways as required by the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. Various environmental and union groups had sued to block the move, citing clean air and vehicle safety concerns, but the Supreme Court said it's not the federal government's job to consider such factors when following free trade obligations.
Instead of passing an extension for unemployment benefits, a new bill approved by the House on Thursday seeks to set up so-called reemployment accounts. Unemployed workers could receive up to $3,000 in a personal account for use in getting a job. However, the exact amount will be up to each state to determine, and to be eligible, a person must be able to prove they are likely to exhaust their unemployment benefits.
Although independent trade unions are currently illegal in Iraq under the law of the occupying authorities, the Federation of Workers' Councils and Unions in Iraq continues to work on a draft labor law to be implemented following the planned restoration of sovereignty at the end of June. And it's setting its sights high, a maximum 6-hour working day or 30-hour work week, retirement at age 55, double pay for working nighttime hours, and a minimum 36 days of vacation per year are just some of the provisions in the draft legislation.
10,000 striking home health care workers in New York City declared a partial victory on Monday when their union, the Service Employees International Local 1199, reached a tentative new contract. Home health care workers' average pay is $7 per hour, but under the terms of the new agreement, their wages will increase to $10 per hour in the next 3 years. However, the tentative settlement only covers half of the total 23,000 striking health care workers throughout the city. The other half will remain on strike through Wednesday.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The nation's unemployment rate for May remained steady at 5.6%, even though there were 250,000 new jobs generated last month, and the number of unemployed people counted by the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics actually rose by 39,000. The Economic Policy Institute qualifies this as a solid job market recovery, but notes it takes the average American looking for a job 5 months now to find success.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Jane, Jane, Jane.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 27 minutes before the hour. We've got a great guest in just a minute, Sam Pizzagatti, who is a labor journalist and has written an extraordinary book that I really want you to know about. However, first we've got a couple of calls. I just want to kind of take care of unfinished business here before we go along to Sam. Let's see. Tony in Washington, D.C. is on the line. Hey, Tony, what's up?
How you doing, brother? Keep telling good news.
I'll do my best.
Mine's very short, and I think my answer's off the air, because I know you have a guest coming up. Don't you think it's totally disrespectful for them to gallivant and politicize, and I feel sorry for the Reagan family, I'm going to say that first off, to have his flag draped all over the media, but the people who were dying for the invasion of Iraq is not even having their picture taken going into the plane?
I think it's terrible. And in fact, Reagan attended funerals. When we lost our men in Lebanon, I don't know if he went to a ceremony or a funeral, but he did. He went to some sort of a ceremony that was around that. Bill Clinton attended funerals. I mean, virtually every president, all the way back to Abraham Lincoln, probably well back before that, has attended funerals of the fallen in war. Only George W. Bush has never attended a single funeral. Of course, he never attended any of the funerals of the 136 people he put to death in Texas either. So
I just wish. Hopefully some right-wing call and explain that one to me.
Yeah.
If they will.
It ain't going to happen, Tony.
It ain't going to happen. Yeah. Take care now.
Thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. Kodak in Durham, North Carolina. Hey, Kodak, what's up?
Yes, I call regarding the opening up the borders to the Mexican trucks. That's definitely a tactic that's going to use to bust the union.
Yeah, we should let our listeners know, Kodak, you're a trucker listening on Sirius Radio, yeah.
Yes, and what a lot of people may not understand is that the grocery strike that went on around the country, a lot of that involved the warehousing, not just the stocking in your local store where the big trucks actually come in. But the other thing that is being a member of the independent owner-operators concern is about the opening up the borders. It's not just the emissions, but it's the safety regulations that are imposed here in the United States.
Yeah.
You have to remember a large transfer truck or even the dump trucks out here have a license to carry 80,000 pounds. So we're talking a very, very high rate of regulations that are involved here in operating a truck.
Yeah, you're talking something that's essentially a deadly weapon. I mean,
exactly. There's no way to enforce them coming across the border.
Yeah.
So it's really a tragic, and it's been an issue amongst the trucking industry for a while now, and maybe the Americans can get on board and help. Another thing that Americans fail to also to realize about truck driving and the industry is that everything in your life, everything that you use in your home and your daily routine comes to you by way of freight trucking.
Yeah, or at least the vast majority of it. Good point, Kodak. I appreciate it. Thanks for the call. And the other point here is, keep in mind, this was a Supreme Court decision. Yes, it was initiated by the Bush administration wanting to get this thing through. But this illustrates the stakes of the election that's coming up here in November, because whoever is president in 2004 is it going to nominate at least, in all probability, two members of the United States Supreme Court, and probably change the course of this nation in ways that are very difficult to predict right now, but no doubt will be significant for at least a generation. Sam Pizzagatti is a labor journalist whose articles and op-eds about inequality have appeared in the New York Times, the Baltimore Sun, the Los Angeles Times, and a host of other periodicals. The author of two previous books. He recently stepped down after 20 years directing the publishing operations of America's largest union, the 2.7 million member National Education Association. Sam has written an extraordinary book and about greed. Greed is good, Sam?
No, greed is not good, but the book is titled Greed and Good, because I think we really need to understand what greed does to our society if we're going to build a good society.
Yeah, and you do it eloquently, although at some length. It's a substantial book. I mean, this is a book for somebody who really wants to get the details of this thing. But first of all, let's talk about the union stuff. I'm assuming that you're familiar with the Wagner Act of 1935 and the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947.
Yes.
And how the Wagner Act basically created legalized unionization in the United States and union shops, and Taft-Hartley, over the veto of President Roosevelt, rolled back many of those provisions and began the destruction of the labor movement in the United States. It took some time. It wasn't until Reagan came along and really aggressively started using this thing. Do you think that there's any chance at all that Taft-Hartley will be repealed, or that we'll ever get back to the kind of balance in power between labor and management that helped create the middle class in America?
Well, I certainly hope so, and I do believe that there are reasons for optimism. If you look back in the late 1920s, which, like today, was a time of enormous and grotesque inequality in our country, the labor movement at that time appeared virtually dead, totally lifeless. But yet, within a half a dozen years after the late 1920s, we were in the midst of an enormous labor upsurge in this country, an upsurge that created, as you just noted, the first mass modern middle-class nation in the history of the world. Yeah. If it happened back then, maybe it can happen again.
Now, that vast inequality, and I think most Americans don't realize this. They think of the Roaring Twenties, and they think everybody was living good. The Roaring Twenties, basically, were times when the very rich were getting incredibly rich, and there was this huge, there was virtually no middle class, and what small middle class there was, obviously, interestingly, radio was the first thing that was offered on credit. It was, RCA Victor started offering radios on credit, and that began the whole credit thing. And what small middle class there may have been was deeply in debt. And we didn't have a middle class at that time. But it took the Great Depression to wake people up. I mean, it took Franklin Roosevelt speaking truths that today would be blasted as socialism, communism. Oh my God, how can he say that by these wackos on the right? I mean, do you think that John Kerry, for example, do you see any other president or any other national figure that's going to have the courage to speak out in the way that Franklin Roosevelt did to bring back the middle class to the United States?
Well, we certainly haven't heard much yet from presidential candidate Kerry, unfortunately, but I'm hopeful that we will. FDR certainly provided the nation courageous leadership back during the Depression and World War II, and he essentially created a modern progressive income tax, and that progressive income tax, combined with the growth of the labor movement in the middle of the 20th century, set the stage for incredible prosperity. In the 25 years after World War II, the real incomes of middle-income Americans doubled. It was a great time to be middle class.
And now we're finding the real incomes of people whose net worth is over $100 million are doubling and quadrupling. But the people,
that's right.
But the net incomes of people who earn less than $150,000 a year have just gone down by 0.6% in the last year. It's the exact opposite. Roosevelt, as I recall, in 1945, actually suggested, let me set this up a little bit better. Thomas Jefferson, in his letters and in his letters to James Madison specifically, suggested that there was a point at which acquired wealth, would render an individual or an organization, if it controlled that wealth. I mean, the corporate form was pretty much well under control then, because they had learned their lesson from the British East India Company. But that there was a certain level of wealth that Jefferson referred to as, quote, dangerous to democracy, end quote. And after he translated in 1804 Desuet de Tracy's treatise on economics from the French to the English, secretly, by the way, because Napoleon would have declared a war over it. I mean, Jefferson got into an economics in a big way during that time and went through this period of extraordinary enlightenment. And he suggested that it should be made impossible for a generation to pass on to the next generation wealth that could corrupt democracy. In other words, he was suggesting a very, very high inheritance tax. And in fact, that's been on and off policy of the United States for years and years. Now, in 1945, Roosevelt took it a step further, and he said there should be a maximum income. Forget about income tax. There should be a maximum income. Anybody here who earns over $300,000 a year in today's dollars, back then it was $25,000, should pay 100% tax on everything over that. How was that received? What happened there?
Well, actually, it was Roosevelt first proposed that in 1942, early in World War II, and the response was very favorable. Anne Sheridan, the actress, do you remember her?
I do.
A famous actress. She said, "I regret that I have only one income to give to the country."
But we were at war then. I mean, you know, there was a sense of sacrifice. People were rationing gasoline and saving tinfoil and things. I mean, that mentality no longer prevails.
That's right. And in fact, there's one statistic that shows how much that mentality no longer prevails. At the height of World War II, the very richest Americans, after taking advantage of all the tax loopholes they could find, paid 78% of their total incomes in federal income tax. Last year, the very richest Americans paid 17.5% of their total incomes in federal income tax. We're in a global war right now. We were in a global war back then in World War II, but the reactions of the tax system were totally different.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I disagree that we're in a war right now, but that's really beside the point. Here's the thing. You know, the cons are all going to hear you say this, the conservatives out there, and they're going to go, "Oh my God, a 90% tax, 70%, 78% tax. Nobody's going to want to create a business. Nobody's going to want to do anything. Everybody's going to suddenly get the urge to just sit on their butt, and America's not going to progress, and we're not going to have entrepreneurs, and nothing's going to happen, and we're going to go down the tubes, and the Soviets are going to eat our lunch, and China's going to take us over, and it's going to be the end of the country." How do you respond?
That's right. That's what they say. Look, we certainly need incentives in our society, economic incentives, but that doesn't mean that all incentives are valid, are valuable. Take, for example, a classroom. What if a teacher started handing out $100 bills to students who got A's? We would be aghast. Because we know that would create a cutthroat environment in the classroom. It would encourage all sorts of cheating. We would never stand for that.
Although, to some extent, that's what we're doing right now with this No Child Left Behind thing. And the only way to get into college now is standardized tests. And with this new economy that Clinton and Bush have brought to us. If you don't have a college education, I mean, Marriott used to brag about the fact that 35% of their bellmen had bachelor's degrees. I mean, you know, pardon my interrupting you, but I think we're actually doing to some extent what you're describing.
Unfortunately, in the current climate, I think you're right. We're in a situation where we're dangling such huge rewards in front of our most powerful business executives that we're encouraging dangerous, risky, perilous behavior that hurts other people. One analogy I like to use is, say you were walking down a busy highway along the shoulder, and cars were zipping by at 55 miles an hour. Traffic was fairly heavy. If you saw a dollar bill sitting under a rock on the other side of the road, would you cross the highway to get that dollar bill? Of course not. You know, you might kill yourself. You might cause an accident. But if you saw on the other side of the road stacks and stacks and stacks of $1,000 bills, then what would happen? Well, some people might cross the road in that situation, even though they might cause an accident. And that's the situation we have in corporate America today, with the huge incentive rewards that top executives can make.
So, Sam, we're talking with Sam Pizzicati. Sam, am I pronouncing your last name right, Pizzicati?
Pizzicati. Uh-huh.
Pizzicati. Okay. Who has written this book, Greed and Good, a marvelous, well-thought-out, well-detailed, extraordinary, in-depth analysis of the situation. You are suggesting, it appears to me, that we should have limits on income, that we should go back to a highly progressive income tax with perhaps a 70% cap like we had during Jack Kennedy, or 90% cap during Roosevelt's era. the time of the great middle class of America, that we should go back to that we should roll back provisions of Taft-Hartley and stop the organized war on organized labor that the conservatives have declared, and that this redistribution of wealth, to quote the freak out phrase for the conservatives, would actually be a good thing for democracy. It would be a good thing for all of us. What evidence do you have of that?
Well, we've actually had a redistribution of wealth over the past 25 years, but it's been a redistribution from average people into the pockets of very wealthy people in our society. That's the redistribution that I think we should undo. Back in the 1950s and 1960s, when America was becoming a more equal nation, middle-class people did very well in that society. Their real incomes doubled. In the 25 years since then, years when America has been growing more unequal, the living standards of middle-class people have declined. And in fact, the average income of the bottom 90% of the American people, after adjusting for inflation, dropped 7% between 1973 and the year 2000.
Yeah.
Trickle down doesn't work.
Trickle down definitely doesn't work. And we've seen, anybody who remembers, anybody who's old enough to remember what it was like, what America was like in the 50s, 60s, and even early 70s, when there actually was a strong middle class, knows it. You know, Ronald Reagan led the charge, destroying this thing. We're talking with Sam Piscitati, a labor journalist and author of Greed and Good.
Do you want to own a computer? Is your credit less than perfect? If you have a checking account and can afford a weekly payment of $29.95 for just 12 months, then you are already approved for a brand new IBM, Dell, eMachine, or other name brand computer guaranteed. You heard right. Bad credit? No credit? No problem. There is no credit check, so you will not be turned down. If you have a checking account and can afford a weekly payment of $29.95 for just 12 months, you are approved for your brand new name brand computer. Just call 800-588-0596. Freedom Frog Funding says you are approved. So give us a call today at 800-588-0596 to have your brand new computer shipped right to you. And if you act now, we'll add a $200 upgrade and a one-year warranty for free. You heard right. We will upgrade your computer and throw in a warranty absolutely free. So don't wait. Let Freedom Frog Funding send you the computer of your dreams today. Call 800-588-0596. That number is 800-588-0596.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. Join me this October as we explore Greece, the ancient birthplace of democracy. When the founding fathers were searching for the best and fairest form of government, they studied the models of Athenian democracy. We'll explore together this part of the ancient world where the ideas that today animate modern democracy were first worked out. This journey is set on the shore of the sparkling Mediterranean Sea with the sacred mountains of Crete behind us. We'll visit the ancient site of Gortian, famous for the Law Code of Gortian, large 6th century BC tablets of stone built into a wall and one of the first examples of laws ever written down, and now the oldest still in existence. I'll teach workshops at the two most important sites in all of Crete, Knossos and Phaistos, plus more. At Knossos, we'll experience the main ceremonial center and the palace of King Minos. For information on how you can join us on this trip of a lifetime, visit www.tomhartman.com or call 1-800-234-TOUR. That's 1-800-234-TOUR, T-O-U-R.
Who is it?
Special delivery.
Who?
Pizza Man.
Hey, you're not the Pizza Man. You're the cable guy. Again.
Price Patrol.
No, you're not. I can see your van. You're the cable company. I'm not going to let you raise my rates again. I'm calling American Satellite to get a direct TV system.
Presidential candidate.
Are you going to offer me over 125 digital quality channels for as little as $39.99 a month, including my local channels?
Ice Cream Man.
Yeah, like that's going to work. If I call American Satellite right now, I can get a four-room direct TV system, including professional installation free. Can you beat that?
Pizza Man.
You already tried that. Well, that's it. I'm calling to get my direct TV system.
Call 800-505-1546. That's 800-505-1546. For new customers only. Annual programming commitment required. Ask how you can get your first 6 months for only $29.99 a month of $60 value. Offer ends July 17. Call now. 800-505-1546.
creatures in the deep ocean adapt to life in a dark and dangerous world. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. The middle zone of the deep ocean is a very dark place. Little sunlight penetrates to depths of 600 feet or more, and we would find it impossible to see anything down there. On the other hand, deep sea creatures are well suited for survival in this cold, dark world. Tracy Sutton is a marine scientist at the Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institution. He studies animals that live between 600 and 1,000 feet deep, and he says a lot of them can see in the dark.
The eyes of the animals down there, they're modified so that they can see any little available light. So they don't form a real good image, but their eyes are super, super sensitive. Their eyes are more sensitive than any instruments we have to measure light.
Sutton says good eyesight helps predators find their prey. Those other creatures have to take care not to be seen. Sutton says that's not easy because there's nothing to hide behind.
Most of these animals spend their entire lives without seeing a solid object. They don't see the bottom. They don't see the surface. They just float in this midwater zone where there's just nowhere to hide at all.
Since there's nowhere to hide, the creatures of the deep have tried to make themselves harder to see.
The fishes are jet black. Other things are completely transparent. And often when you catch them and you look in a trawl bucket, you can't tell that it's there until you pour it out and then you see, oh, there's lots of stuff in there. It was just transparent.
Sutton says most deep-sea animals are less than a foot long, but they have surprisingly big heads, teeth, and fangs. Food is scarce in the open water, and they need to be able to eat almost anything they can find. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
Is the Tom Hartman Program.
For the history books tell it, they tell it so well.
And welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour. It's Tom Hartman with you. We're talking with Sam Pizzagatti, the author of Greed and Good. www.greedandgood.org is the website for the book. And Sam, let's take a quick call. We've got a trucker from Santa Fe, New Mexico on the line. Hey, trucker, you're on the air. What's your name?
Hello.
Hi.
I'm a cab driver. Sorry. I think there's a...
Oh, that's quite all right.
There.
Okay.
90% tax is a bad idea because regardless of who you vote for or what you believe in, I always think it's a really bad idea to trust the government with 90% of your money. Just because you're successful, I don't think you should be punished. And quite honestly, I'm kind of a libertarian, and I can imagine there's probably a lot of liberals out there who would really hate a Republican administration to be in charge of 90% of what they earn. I'm sure there's a lot of Republicans who would really not prefer to have the Democrats be in charge of 90% of what they earn, because it's all going to go for bureaucracy and weapons, basically, and it's a bad idea.
Okay. Your point is well made and eloquent. Sam, your response?
Well, there are a lot of points there. Let me just take one. I'm not interested in penalizing success at all. I just like to make sure that the rewards from success are equally shared to all people who contribute to that success. We have right now in our country CEOs who are making 300, 400, 500 times more than the workers that they the workers in their companies
who are actually producing the product.
That's right. And we need an economy where people who make a contribution are rewarded. And right now, a disproportionate share of the rewards are going to the top of our society.
Yeah, in the 1970s, the typical CEO made 30, 40, 50 times what his bottom employees make. You know, in the civil service and in most universities, there's an absolute limit of 10 to 1 or 20 to 1.
That's right.
You're suggesting going back to something like, now, I'd say to the cab driver, I don't think either you or I are suggesting that people should pay 90% on the first part of their income tax. I mean, I think that it should kick in after $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. Isn't
that
the sort of, that is a progressive tax.
I agree.
Yeah, and in fact, that people who are making under $40,000, $50,000 should be paying a whole lot less in taxes than they are right now, because they're getting stuck with all these hidden taxes and fees and sales tax and user fees and property tax and all these sorts of things. Do you disagree with that, Sam?
No, I agree. The great scientist Sir Francis Bacon a few centuries ago said that wealth is like manure. It only does good when you spread it around. We need a tax system that spreads the wealth around much more than it is today.
Yeah, without becoming a capitalist slash or a socialist slash communist nation, just going back to what we've done in the past that has actually worked, actually created a middle class. Sam Piscotty, Greed and Good is the book, www.greedandgood.org, the website. Sam, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
Two big decisions handed down by the Supreme Court yesterday affecting pension policy and truck traffic. In the first case, two Illinois men who worked construction jobs and then retired at the age of 39 will have their pensions restored to their full amounts. The Central Laborers Pension Fund docked them benefits after the two had gone back to work. The justices did leave the door open for pension funds to adopt restrictions against so-called double-dipping in the future, though, so long as the workers in the fund know about the policy when they join it. The second case clears the way for Mexican truck traffic to travel unimpeded on U.S. highways as required by the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA.
Yep.
Various environmental and union groups had sued to block the move, citing clean air and vehicle safety concerns, but the Supreme Court said it's not the federal government's job to consider such factors when following free trade obligations.
Instead of passing an extension for unemployment benefits, a new bill approved by the House on Thursday seeks to set up so-called reemployment accounts. Unemployed workers could receive up to $3,000 in a personal account for use in getting a job. However, the exact amount will be up to each state to determine, and to be eligible, a person must be able to prove they are likely to exhaust their unemployment benefits.
Although independent trade unions are currently illegal in Iraq under the law of the occupying authorities, the Federation of Workers' Councils and Unions in Iraq continues to work on a draft labor law to be implemented following the planned restoration of sovereignty at the end of June. And it's setting its sights high, a maximum 6-hour working day or 30-hour work week, retirement at age 55, double pay for working nighttime hours, and a minimum 36 days of vacation per year are just some of the provisions in the draft legislation.
10,000 striking home health care workers in New York City declared a partial victory on Monday when their union, the Service Employees International, Local 1199, reached a tentative new contract. Home health care workers' average pay is $7 per hour, but under the terms of the new agreement, their wages will increase to $10 per hour in the next 3 years. However, the tentative settlement only covers half of the total 23,000 striking health care workers throughout the city. The other half will remain on strike through Wednesday.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The nation's unemployment rate for May remained steady at 5.6%, even though there were a quarter million new jobs generated last month, and the number of unemployed people counted by the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics actually rose by 39,000. The Economic Policy Institute qualifies this as a solid job market recovery, but notes it takes the average American looking for a job 5 months now to find success.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Have you visited 100fires.com lately? If not, then you're missing out on thousands of books for a better world. Books about how you can make a difference, about the rights of workers, creating more livable communities, and about how we can stop large corporations from destroying our democracy. 100fires.com offers secure ordering, full searchability, gift certificates, and much, much more. That's 100fires.com. Books for a better world.
It's always enlightening to have the glories of corporate globalization explained to us by conservative pontificators who try to convince us that globalization is the height of morality, for it indirectly aids the poor, a group of people they never care to aid directly. Not long ago, we were treated to an example of such enlightenment by William Safire, the old Nixon speechwriter who's now a pundit for the New York Times. He offered a touching hypothetical story of a low-income mother whose 12-year-old boy had said to her, "Mama, I need new shoes because the old ones with the holes hurt my feet and the other kids in school are laughing at me." But, Safire tells us sadly, his fictional mama had to say to her boy that she couldn't afford no $50 on new shoes made in America. Glory be and hallelujah, though, Sapphire's morality tale ends happily, for Mama found a store that was, quote, "having a clearance of shoes made in China or Indo someplace. I bought him a pair of fine leather shoes for $24. You should have seen my boy's face light up." In case you missed the moral of this literary gem, Sapphire pounds it into us in the next sentence of his column. Free trade is helping that lady make ends meet because her hard-earned dollar now has more buying power. If those fast-talking protectionists had their way, the high cost of living would deny her boy those shoes. Gosh, Bill, thanks for that little lecture. Meanwhile, moving from fiction to real life, you might observe that Nike does not lower the price on its shoes just because it pays workers in Indo someplace a dollar a day instead of the $10 an hour it used to pay U.S. workers. No, Nike simply pockets the savings. Also, if Mama had not had her middle-class job offshored by the likes of Nike, she would not be poor, and then she could afford $50 on new shoes made in America. This is Jim Hightower saying, instead of pushing more trickle-down fantasies, let's invest in America's middle class again.
Hello from Athens, Greece, folks. Now, if you're a big sports fan like me, this is the place to be. They've got them all. Take fencing. My sword of choice is always the foil over the saber and épée. You've got to see it. That's why Econo Lodge and Roadway Inn Hotels have created the Wake Up a Winner sweepstakes. You could win a trip to the big events in Athens. To enter, visit choicehotels.com, or every time you stay at Econo Lodge and Roadway Inn Hotels this summer, you'll get a game piece with a chance to win hundreds of prizes and discounts off your next stay. Wake up a winner. To book, call 800-4-CHOICE or go to choicehotels.com. Well, I'm off to rhythmic gymnastics, where it always comes down to who nails the tightest ribbon snake. Choice Hotels. We'll see you there.
No purchase necessary. Open to legal U.S. residents 18 and older. Void where prohibited. Promotion runs June 7th through August 29th, 2004. For official rules and how to enter without purchase, visit Choice Hotel.
Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 7 minutes past the hour. We have a fascinating guest, Jim Ennis, who was aboard the USS Liberty, which on this day in 1967 was attacked by Israel, killing 34 American soldiers, injuring 172, casualty rate of 70%. A fascinating story. We'll get to that in just a second. First, Shannon, Oklahoma, has been patiently waiting on the line. Hey, Shannon, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how you doing, man? I've read so many of your books. You're a saint.
Well, thank you. I assure you I'm not, but I know how to write a book. So
You do. I agree. I just wanted to respond to the idea of the discomfort of having the government in control of 75% or more of anyone's earned profits over $300,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
With a question, how's it being used now? I mean, if those who wanted to use it to set up organizations to help, you know, anything over $300,000 to set up organizations to help keep people out of poverty, so which of course promotes, you know, crime, suicide, powerlessness induced ignorance of what the government is doing with the money, and the overall, you know, degradation of this country, then I'm sure that it could be set up to invest in well-being of our entire populace and not have to claim it as profit, so it wouldn't actually be taxed like that.
Yeah, well, and that's what Roosevelt did, and that's what Truman did, and that's what Eisenhower, people forget. Eisenhower presided over an era of 90% income tax cap. And John Kennedy actually raised taxes. The cons love to say John Kennedy lowered the top tax rate from 90% to 70%. He was the first trickle down economist. Nonsense. And he said so in his debates with Nixon. He said the fact of the matter is very few people pay that 90% because there's all these loopholes. And he wanted to eliminate the loopholes and set it at 70%, so people actually paid the 70%, which was about what most people were actually paying, who were making over what would in today's dollars would be about $1 million a year. And you know, the answer to your question, what are people doing with that extra money, is they're taking our jobs offshore. They're taking America apart. They're building empires. They're building mansions, and they're taking over our government.
And they're buying news outlets to keep us from seeing any of it, to keep themselves in the ability to do that.
Yeah,
so.
Thomas Jefferson was right. There is a certain point at which wealth is dangerous to democracy. It's just very, very, very much that simple. Shannon, thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for all that you're doing, Tom.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling and for listening. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. James M. Ennis, Jr., Jim Ennis, was the electronic materiel officer on the USS Liberty, and he's the author of a book called Assault on the Liberty, which is widely hailed as the definitive account of the attack on the USS Liberty, which occurred on this day in 1967. 67 is a long time ago. Think back to that. As an officer assigned to the Communications Intercept Department of the USS Liberty, he was severely wounded on the ship's bridge when it was attacked in 67. Jim, tell us what happened, first of all, from your point of view, being on the ship. Where was the ship? What was it doing? What were you guys up to? What happened?
Okay, well, we were an intelligence collection ship, so we had 100 guys down below with earphones and other equipment listening to everything that was going on.
You were actually working for the NSA, were you not?
Well, we got we worked with the NSA. We were Navy, all Navy guys, and we got our tasking from the National Security Agency. But,
right.
We were related to them and did their mission.
Yep. Okay.
So we were assigned to patrol the area just off the Gaza Strip during the Six-Day War.
Mm-hmm.
This was the fourth day of the Six-Day War. I was officer of the deck that morning and came on the bridge at about 7:15, and I was there until noon when I went below. And during that time, we were circled 13 times by Israeli aircraft that came out to identify us, and they did.
Mm-hmm. They knew that you were an American ship, and they probably knew that you were gathering intelligence on what was going on. Now, what were the Israelis doing in that area of Gaza at that point in time?
Well, they had captured the nearest city, which was El Arish, which had been Egyptian until a day or so before we arrived. So they had control of the area near us. In fact, at the very moment that we were passing the city of El Arish, they were in the process of executing illegally up to 1,000 Egyptian prisoners of war at the airport there.
Now,
there is a
book about the National Security Agency which came out, must have been 8 years ago, 6 or 8 years ago. And I was looking all over I've got 6,000 books in this house. I was looking all over for it this morning. I can't remember the title of it. I went on Amazon. They have somehow scrambled their search function. So I typed NSA in, and I got, you know, 7,000 hits or something. And I can't remember the title of it, but it had an entire chapter on the incident of the USS Liberty. And what this book suggested was that the illegal execution of these prisoners of war was being done by Ariel Sharon. Is that, do you know that to be the case?
I don't know that to be the case. In fact, I know only about that when I read. The book you're thinking of is Body of Secrets by Jim Bamford.
That's right. That's right.
And he has a new book coming out today, as a matter of fact.
Oh, interesting. And he's a good guy. He's written, he also wrote Puzzle Palace, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah.
And he came to our reunion last week. So he's very up to date on the Liberty story.
Yeah. So in his book, he suggested that Sharon had something to do with this. You don't have any knowledge of that, specifically.
I don't know anything about that beyond what I read. The funny thing is, a lot of people deny that such executions took place, but that's very well established.
But and so you guys were there, off the coast, and essentially, on behalf of our intelligence service, specifically the National Security Agency, which most people don't realize has about 10 times the budget of the CIA, and back in 1967, it was illegal to even acknowledge, for a federal employee, to even acknowledge that the NSA existed. And which runs most intelligence intercepts, electronic intelligence, things like that. And, working with the Navy on behalf of the NSA, gathering this information and this intelligence. And the Israelis apparently figured out that you were documenting a crime of war, eh?
Yeah, they had no way of knowing what we were doing, but they knew that we were an intelligence ship, and so they were concerned. They were obviously doing something they didn't want us to know about, and so to stop that, they attacked us. They were willing to sink us and kill almost 300 men.
So tell me about the attack. What happened? You're on the bridge of the ship.
All right. And remember that I had been on the bridge of the ship all day. I took a break for an hour, and then I came back from 1 until 2. During this time, we'd been circled 13 times by Israeli aircraft. And every time they circled us, our intercept operators heard them telling their headquarters that we're Americans. So we're pretty confident that we were safe. The Egyptians didn't have anything in the air, and the Israelis did, and they knew we were friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Then at 2 o'clock... I was still
2 o'clock in the afternoon. 2 o'clock in the morning.
2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
I was still on the bridge, and we spotted three Israeli jet airplanes, Mirages, approaching the ship. And here they are. Look at us again. They passed down the starboard side, turned 180 degrees, and came down the center line, firing.
Firing what?
Rockets, missiles, cannon. And later, dropping napalm, I was hit, as was everybody around me. My leg was broken by the very first run that came. But then the airplanes continued to fire for another, for about 20 or 25 minutes. Three torpedo boats approached. The torpedo boats launched five torpedoes, very, very fortunately.
Israeli torpedo boats.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they missed with four of them, blew a 40-foot hole in the side, killed 25 men with one lucky shot. And incredibly, we didn't sink. But and the Israelis claim that at that point they recognized us as American and stopped firing. And that's the biggest lie of all. They came in within 50 feet and continued to fire at anything that moved, including firefighters and stretcher bearers and all those things, and circled us for another 40 minutes, firing from close range, trying to penetrate our boilers.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, and incidentally jamming our radios. They couldn't jam our radios without knowing who we were.
Sure.
So... finally, quarter after three, an hour and a quarter after it all started, Sixth Fleet finally got our messages where we broke through the jamming and told us that help is on the way, which they no doubt heard. So they withdrew their torpedo boats.
Hmm. And that was the end of the attack. And at that point, you had 37 sailors on your ship dead and 172 injured among yourself, including yourself?
Yeah, 34 and 172 injured, including myself.
That's it's absolutely remarkable. Now, after the attack, Of course, the official Israeli position was, we didn't know what the ship was. We attacked it in the middle of the attack. We heard them, you know, communicating in a way that you know, caused us to realize they were Americans, and at that point we stopped. You say, and Bamford says in his book, you know, nonsense. What happened when the survivors of the ship, yourself included, tried to tell your story?
We were told that if we tell the story, we go to jail.
If you told the story to whom?
To anyone. In fact, most of us got visits from senior officers. I had a Navy captain come to my hospital room and tell me that if I ever talk about this, I go to jail. And you don't tell your mother, your sister, your friends, or your wife. You don't talk about this, period.
Why?
That's funny. What their story is, well, everything that can be told about it has been told, so there's nothing more for you to say. Now, in a few cases where the press asked to interview survivors, the survivors were then rehearsed for 2 or 3 hours and on just what they would say, and then the public affairs officers sat in the room, and if they strained anywhere toward telling what actually happened or how long the attack lasted or the fact that they machine gun our life rafts in the water or anything like that, the survivor was quieted, and the reporter was told that we couldn't talk about those things.
So this has been, it's been what, 30, I can't do my math this fast, 38 years?
37 years.
37 years now, yeah. By the way, for our listeners, we're talking to Jim Ennis, E-N-N-E-S. He was the electronic material officer aboard the USS Liberty. The USS Liberty was an intelligence gathering ship off the Gaza Strip in 1967 during the Six-Day War, was it called?
That's right.
Yeah, and that was attacked by the Israelis, and to this day is an enigma wrapped in a riddle. He's written a book called Assault on the Liberty, which you can find in bookstores all over. Jim, I got a couple more questions for you, if you can stick around for just a minute.
I will.
Okay, 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Stay tuned.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Do you want to own a computer? Is your credit less than perfect? If you have a checking account and can afford a weekly payment of $29.95 for just 12 months, then you are already approved for a brand new IBM, Dell, eMachine, or other name brand computer guaranteed. You heard right. Bad credit? No credit? No problem. There is no credit check, so you will not be turned down. If you have a checking account and can afford a weekly payment of $29.95 for just 12 months, you are approved for your brand new name brand computer. Just call 800-588-0596. Freedom Frog Funding says you are approved. So give us a call today at 800-588-0596 to have your brand new computer shipped right to you. And if you act now, we'll add a $200 upgrade and a one-year warranty for free. You heard right. We will upgrade your computer and throw in a warranty absolutely free. So don't wait. Let Freedom Frog Funding send you the computer of your dreams today. call 800-588-0596. That number is 800-588-0596.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about The Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Has George W. Bush delivered on his 2000 campaign pledge to run the government more like a business? New reports from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and Office of Personnel Management show that the federal workforce grew by a net 70,000 since Bush took office. And these numbers don't even count contractors who now compete for federal work. Of the 12 million people who work in some capacity for the federal government, less than 2 million are actually employed by government agencies.
In the foreword to Tom Hartman's book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late, renowned author Joseph Chilton Pierce writes,
"To discover brilliant, innovative, creative, and original thinking is one of life's rare privileges. To discover that such a thinker has focused on the most critical of all issues facing our species is encouraging. Because The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight is a seminal work, offering a viewpoint original yet ancient, I see our situation today in a new light. And because of the scope and depth of this work, I find it inspiring as well as disturbing. I rather exhausted superlative in praise of Tom Hartman's book, The Prophet's Way, which I rightly called the most important book I've ever read. But now I find this sequel calling for equal praise, since the issue here addresses the whole of our species, and indeed all species."
The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late by Tom Hartman, in bookstores everywhere.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Casey joins the hollow sound of silent people walking down the stairway to the subway in the shadows down below.
And welcome back. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Jim Ennis, who is an officer on the USS Liberty, the author of Assault on the Liberty. Jim, is there a website for your book or for information about it?
I was hoping you'd ask. It's ussliberty.org.
.org, okay. Now, at the time, this is 1967, when we were attacked, one of our intelligence-gathering ships was attacked by an ally, and many associated with that ship allege that the ship was documenting some serious war crimes by that ally, and that that's may have been why it was attacked. I don't know if you're saying that in your book or not. I can tell you Banford did in his book. And are you, by the way? Are you making that assertion?
No, I don't believe they had a clue what we were doing, but they were afraid that we were capable of it, and that was enough.
Yeah, are you capable of documenting the fact that there was a slaughter going on?
Yeah, and incidentally, while we're on the subject of Banford, the title of his new book, released today, is A Pretext for War.
About Iraq?
About the, yes, Iraq and the abuse of America's intelligence agencies. You need to interview this guy.
Oh, I'll have to look for it. Yeah, I've read two of his books, and I think he's brilliant. Now, here's the question. In 1967, when this happened, you were wounded. Your leg was broken by a bullet or shrapnel?
Missile fragment,
okay. And everybody on the ship was told, and LBJ was president, and everybody on the ship was told, we are not going to tell the world, A, the kind of intelligence that this ship was gathering. That's a secret. And although it apparently was an open secret among the men on the ship. And B, that the Israelis knew that this was an American ship before they undertook the attack. And that if you said that, you would go to jail, correct?
That's correct.
How come you're not in jail?
I don't think. I never did think it was a legal order, which is why I wrote the book. In fact, after I wrote the book, we had people like Secretary of State Dean Rusk, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Admiral Tom Moore, CIA Director Richard Helms, and a whole long list of people in those positions who said, hey, Ennis is right, it was deliberate.
Yeah.
We've got some powerful support.
Yeah. So do you know of any other times when we have been attacked by an ally like this?
I'm not aware of one.
Yeah. I am frankly not either. I mean, you know, friendly fire happens. You know, we killed some Canadians when we went into Afghanistan, things like that. But I don't know of anything like this. What would you like? And you said you just attended a reunion last week. I'm assuming it was a reunion of people who were involved in the USS Liberty?
Right. They're all survivors.
Yeah, the survivors of the ship. What's the consensus? What would you like to see come out of this now here 37 years later?
Well, we'd like to see an official investigation. There was a Navy investigation, and in fact, the Navy investigation reported that it could have been an accident, and we've got a signed statement from the legal counsel to that board of investigation saying that they lied. They were directed by the President of the United States to lie.
Lyndon Johnson at the time.
That's right.
What was LBJ so afraid of?
Well, my department head, Commander Dave Lewis, talked to Commander of the 6th Fleet, who told him that I wouldn't defend your ship because I didn't want to embarrass an ally.
Yeah. So it has to do with international geopolitics and sacrifice a small bunch of people for a greater good and all that kind of rationalization nonsense.
Exactly.
Rather than
Israel is so close that even if they kill 34 of our men, we're not going to confront them about it.
Yeah, it's sacrosanct. James Ennis, the author of Assault on the Liberty. The website again, Jim?
USSLiberty.org, and there's a discussion at USSLibertyInquiry.com.
Great. Thank you very much, Jim. I appreciate your being on the program. The book, Assault on the Liberty. It's 29 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. Ed Hallowell, a nationally recognized expert on ADD, said this about the Edison Gene.
Tom Hartman demonstrates that ADHD can be associated with creativity, high achievement, and a most successful adaptive style.
The Edison Gene, now available in bookstores everywhere.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
Two big decisions handed down by the Supreme Court yesterday affecting pension policy and truck traffic. In the first case, two Illinois men who worked construction jobs and then retired at the age of 39 will have their pensions restored to their full amounts. The Central Laborers Pension Fund docked them benefits after the two had gone back to work. The justices did leave the door open for pension funds to adopt restrictions against so-called double dipping in the future, though, so long as the workers in the fund know about the policy when they join it. The second case clears the way for Mexican truck traffic to travel unimpeded on U.S. highways as required by the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. Various environmental and union groups had sued to block the move, citing clean air and vehicle safety concerns, but the Supreme Court said it's not the federal government's job to consider such factors when following free trade obligations.
Instead of passing an extension for unemployment benefits, a new bill approved by the House on Thursday seeks to set up so-called reemployment accounts. Unemployed workers could receive up to $3,000 in a personal account for use in getting a job. However, the exact amount will be up to each state to determine, and to be eligible, a person must be able to prove they are likely to exhaust their unemployment benefits.
Although independent trade unions are currently illegal in Iraq under the law of the occupying authorities, the Federation of Workers' Councils and Unions in Iraq continues to work on a draft labor law to be implemented following the planned restoration of sovereignty at the end of June. And it's setting its sights high. A maximum 6-hour working day or 30 continues to work on a draft labor law to be implemented following the planned restoration of sovereignty at the end of June. And it's setting its sights high. A maximum 6-hour working day or 30-hour work week, retirement at age 55, double pay for working nighttime hours, and a minimum 36 days of vacation per year are just some of the provisions in the draft legislation.
10,000 striking home health care workers in New York City declared a partial victory on Monday when their union, the Service Employees International Local 1199, reached a tentative new contract. Home health care workers' average pay is $7 per hour, but under the terms of the new agreement, their wages will increase to $10 per hour in the next 3 years. However, the tentative settlement only covers half of the total 23,000 striking health care workers.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Got to go back. We got to go back. Got to go back. Got to go back. For the healing.
And we've got to heal this nation. And we've got to once again capture the dream of an egalitarian America. A liberal America, an America that is a beacon of liberty and freedom to the world, that actually follows its own rules and doesn't throw people in jail without due process to law, without access to an attorney. There is so much that we need to do, that we just absolutely must be doing, must be, you know, getting active about. It's remarkable. I received one of the emails that I got yesterday or the day before was from somebody complaining about the fact that Reagan has been that all the coverage of Reagan has lionized him, and very few people have pointed out the many failings and destructive behaviors of his administration. I mean, I'm talking about national coverage. And the comment was, you know, I feel like I can't do anything. Why bother? You know, why even try? Nobody's paying any attention, blah, 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 blah. Let me tell you, that's what they want you to think. That's the message they want to convey. You know, one of the most interesting things that I've learned in this last year, and I learned this from watching an interview, I think with Chris Matthews, with John Zogby, the guy who does the polling, is that when negative ads are run in political campaigns, it doesn't increase the vote for the guy who's running the negative ads. It decreases the vote for the guy who the negative ad is the victim of. In other words, fewer people go to the polls. The purpose of negative ad campaigning is to get people not to vote. And we have to see through that. We have to awaken to it. We have to say we're not, you know, no, it's not going to happen. And to get active, to get out there and to get active, to get on blogs, to get a call into radio. I mean, the cons have been doing this for 30 years so successfully that they have taken over the government of the United States. We can do the same. Start calling in to radio talk shows that you disagree with. Start writing letters to the editor of the newspapers. Start participating. Contact your elected officials. Offer to pull together a group of 10 or 20 or 30 people in your community and contact your member of Congress and say, would you come speak to us? We would like to talk with you. Odds are you'll get it. There is just a lot that can be done. There is a lot that can be done. Speaking of which, What needs to be done? Jaws. Our Bush Green Watch alert. Report describes administration laxity on chemical plant safety. The Bush administration's recent grave warnings that terrorists may attack on American soil this summer came amidst mounting criticism that the president is doing little or nothing to protect Americans from potential chemical attacks. A new report by the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. Another, by the way, another one of these fine groups that Ralph Nader started, this is what he should stick to. He changed the world of American politics in many positive ways by doing things like creating the public interest research groups. Why doesn't he stick to this? Anyway, a new report by the U.S. Public Interest Research Group finds that terrorist attacks or incidents at any of 12 companies in this country could endanger more than 5 million Americans near each of these sites. 12 different sites, each one 5 million Americans. Was it 60 million people with 12 attacks? All are vulnerable because of a lack of federal security regulations. Rick Hind, the legislative director of Greenpeace Toxic Campaign, said, quote, "It's a classic demonstration of the hypocrisy of the administration. On the one hand, eroding civil liberties as part of its homeland security efforts, and on the other hand, being unwilling to regulate oil and chemical companies who are close friends of this administration. There are no real preventative measures for protecting Americans from chemical attacks or terrorist attacks involving chemical companies," he said. And, of course, as we know, as I've reported many times in the last year and a half, 2 years here on this program, the reason why is because the chemical companies have been spreading money around like manure in Washington, D.C., saying, you know, we'll take care of things. Don't worry. Everything's fine. Make people take their shoes off at the airport. But don't worry about our chemical facilities. That would cost us some profit. CBS News reports taxpayers' dollars, precious taxpayer dollars, in fact, to use the phrase of CBS News correspondent Mike Brzezinski, precious taxpayer dollars are quietly going to pay for security at some of the richest corporations in the world. Mr. Bush says, I'm sorry, we don't have the money to keep those 100,000 cops on the street that Bill Clinton put out there. They're gone. No, we don't have money for the new radios for New York City Police and Fire Department. No, we don't have money for the first offenders. Nope, sorry. But we can sure find money to give to the oil companies. Major oil companies have received $65 million of your and my tax money. $65 million to buy cameras, fencing, and communications equipment. The president of the American Public Transit Association, Bill Miller, asks why these profitable private companies are receiving scarce taxpayer dollars while publicly funded entities like the transit system, with Americans riding 32 million times a day, are left underfunded and underprotected. But, you know, let's just look at the details. CITGO, they've been advertising on TV a lot lately. I find it interesting. Whenever you see an ad that doesn't say, please buy our gasoline, the purpose of the ad, more often than not, is to try and influence the medium upon which the ad is running. CITGO made a $439 million profit but took $19.4 million in government grants. Wasn't that sweet of them? ConocoPhillips earned $4.7 billion in profits. By the way, all the while jacking up the price of gasoline, I don't know if you've noticed that, but I can tell you that people who watch the stock market know that the oil companies are making out like bandits right now. $4.7 billion in profits, ConocoPhillips. That's not revenue, that's profits. That's what's left over at the end of the day that gets to be split up among the people who make their livings by sitting on their butts around the pool waiting for their dividend checks to arrive so they don't have to pay payroll tax, like those of us who actually work for a living. They don't have to pay income tax above 15%, no matter how much money they make, thanks to the Bush so-called tax cuts. ConocoPhillips earned a $4.7 billion profit, but $10.8 million of your tax dollars and mine were given to them. to put up fences and camera communications equipment. We can't afford to give it to the New York City Police Department, but we can give it to ConocoPhillips, even though they showed a $4.5 billion profit. Chevron Texaco. You think Conoco, with a $4.7 billion profit, was doing good. Chevron Texaco netted a whopping $7.2 billion. Keep in mind, a billion is a thousand million. Chevron Texaco netted a whopping $7.2 billion profit, but several of its facilities still got over $7.3 million in government handouts. So, that our Bush watch for the day. Yes, they're coming for your money and mine. And who are they going to give it to? Their friends in the chemical industry and the oil industry. What a surprise. What a surprise. What a surprise. What? How shocking. How shocking. Speaking of oil companies, in fact, Business Week on June 7th, Business Week, ran an article called The Bright Side of $40 a Barrel. There is a bright side. If you're an investor in an oil company, they say that the oil companies, quote, are using cash to buy back stock, pay down debt, and up dividends. It was a record oil and gas price yield. Oh, record oil and gas prices yield record profits for President Bush's friends and campaign contributors in the oil and gas industry. This from Consumers Union. Domestic petroleum industry profits are headed for another record. First quarter 2004 filings show domestic refining and marketing profits up 50% compared with the first quarter of 2003, while company-wide profits are up 17%. Now, why is that? It's because Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. And these companies started buying each other out and getting bigger and bigger and bigger until there just isn't any competition left. Anybody who thinks there's competition in the oil industry believes in the Easter Bunny. The conservative agenda is overtly anti-competitive. Anti-competitive. You say, but wait a minute. Lush Bimbaugh is always talking about how we got to have more competition. We got to have more companies. No, it's anti-competitive. The big get bigger, and competition suffers. It's really very simple. We had competition in the United States from the founding of this country until the 1870s, and by the 1880s, these large corporations were starting to form. By the way, Thomas Jefferson recommending his high tax on inheritance because he didn't want to see American landed gentry. He didn't want to see American dynasties happen. Is the reason why there are no dynasties left over from the founding families. All of the American dynasties that you can point to go back to the 1880s. That's when it began. Prior to that, we had inheritance laws that just, made it impossible. Sorry, you can get wealthy, but you can't become the crown prince of the nation, the state, or the county or whatever. And so Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. George Bush Sr. continued with that process. And, of course, Reagan, when Reagan first stopped enforcing it, it was a big deal. I mean, those of you who remember the early 1980s and Michael Milken and all these guys and the M&A mania, mergers and acquisition mania, because now it was legal for corporations to buy each other rather than having to compete against each other. The last president who believed in competition was Jimmy Carter. He broke up AT&T because he said they're non-competitive. Just break them into smaller pieces and let them compete with each other. It'll help the consumers. Bill Clinton in 1996 signed the Telecommunications Act, which reversed that to a large extent. All of these economic conservatives, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush, have been largely anti-competition. And that's why you're seeing these mind-boggling profits. At the same time, you're seeing mind-boggling prices at the gas pump. Octane week. You know, let's listen to the oil company talk to themselves. Well, here, first, Consumers Union in May. Domestic petroleum industry profits are headed for another record. First quarter 2004 filings show domestic refining and marketing profits up 50% compared to the first quarter of 2003, while company-wide profits are up about 17%. And here from Octane Week, now, the oil industry talking to itself, quote, oil company quarterly earnings have been making headlines not just on financial pages, but in congressional journals as well. And they're starting to worry. Lawmakers in the nation's capital and state house around the country have been railing at gasoline prices and oil company profits. All the rhetoric is unlikely to change gasoline prices in the near term. In other words, we don't have to worry about what these politicians say. They'll go out and they'll run around and they'll yell and scream and squeal and pound their fists on the table, but then our lobbyists will show up and hand them an envelope full of cash. In fact, Octane Week says, if anything, fundamentals are more likely to push retail prices higher, which will be bullish for company profits in this and coming quarters. Fundamentals? Excuse me? When fundamentals increase profits, that has nothing to do with the classic definition of fundamentals, as in supply and demand. That has to do with collusion. That has to do with anti-competitiveness. That has to do with the old boy network. Now, why is Bush standing by as the oil and gas executives take middle-class Americans to the cleaners? Because, once again, the oil and gas industry is bankrolling George W.'s campaign. ConocoPhillips profits up 32%. You will recall ConocoPhillips profits were pretty mind-boggling there. What was it? It's on the other page here. No. Anyhow, ConocoPhillips. 32% increase in profits. The company's chairman is one of Bush's pioneers. This from USA Today. ConocoPhillips, the number three U.S. oil company, recorded first quarter earnings Wednesday of $1.6 billion, up 33% from $1.2 billion in the first quarter last year, and about 17% more than Wall Street had forecast. Archie Dunham, chairman of ConocoPhillips, was a Bush pioneer, as was Cameron Cooper and Cameron Erickson and 47 other.
The following phone call was not recorded on February 30th, 2004.
Thank you for calling about DirecTV. My name is Lynn. How can I help you?
Thank you, sir. Thank goodness you're there. You've got to help me. My cable company is raising their rates again. I don't know what I'm going to do.
It's okay, ma'am. I'm here to help. I'm glad you called.
They're taking away our favorite channels and charging more. It's just wrong.
Ma'am, I get that all the time. Let me help you right away. Would you like to get over 125 channels of your favorite programming for only $39.99?
Will I still be able to get my local channels?
Absolutely. And because you called American Satellite right now, you can get up to a four-room DirecTV system for free and free professional installation for all new customers with an annual programming commitment.
Oh, thank you. My husband, Nick, is going to be so happy.
Call American Satellite at 1-800-505-1542. That's 800-505-1542. Call now and ask how you can get total choice for only $29.99 a month for the first 6 months. A $60 value. 800-505-1542. At $4.99 a month per second in each additional receiver. Offer ends July 17, 2004. Call now.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
Are you or a loved one making too many trips to the bathroom? Listen closely because you're not alone. Over 30 million men suffer from an enlarged prostate. That's why if you make frequent trips to the bathroom, have urgency, hesitancy, or a diminished sex drive, then Super Prostate Formula is for you. It was designed by nationally recognized physician Dr. Michael Toplitzky. The results with his patients have been amazing. Reclaim control now and join the thousands of satisfied customers who have had incredible results with Super Prostate Formula. When you order 2 bottles of Dr. Toplitzky's Super Prostate Formula, you'll also get 2 bottles of his Super Libido Formula, an all-natural alternative to Viagra to enhance sexual vitality and performance, plus his book, Complete Guide to Prostate Health, and his newsletter, a total $100 value free as your gift. Guaranteed or your money back. If you're not completely satisfied, return it for a full refund and keep his Libido Formula book and newsletter free as your gift. Not available in stores. Call now. 800-452-0978. 800-452-0978. That's 800-452-0978.
The eastern United States is the scene of one of the largest insect events in the world. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. Cicadas are big brown bugs that spend most of their life underground. Some species emerge every year to reproduce. Others arrive in cycles that run several years. The largest group of all, known as Brood 10, comes up from underground only once every 17 years. When they arrive, everyone knows about it, and this is their year. Mike Raup is an entomologist at the University of Maryland who studies the Brood 10 insects. He says these cicadas are about 1.5 inches long, and they're known for their huge populations.
We hear estimates anywhere from 100,000 to 1.5 million per acre. So these are enormous densities, and these are very large insects for those kinds of densities.
The range of the Brood 10 cicadas extends south from New Jersey to Georgia and as far west as Illinois. Raup says the 17 years they spend underground makes a lot of sense. No predator will live long enough to remember these insects and plan for their return, and Raup says coming out in huge numbers has its own benefits.
It becomes a safety in numbers game. By emerging in huge, huge numbers in any given location, the cicadas simply are far too abundant for any predator to consume them all.
Raup says predators do eat them, and the list of predators includes skunks and squirrels, fish, turtles, snakes, and birds. But the big brown bugs will still manage to produce billions of offspring. They'll be the generation of Brood 10 cicadas that will arrive 17 years from now. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Known you, waiting on you, it's about all I do. Another night, another day, I'm waiting on you.
And welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The Bush-Cheney 2004 campaign had 47 pioneers that were oil and gas industry executives. Surprise, surprise! As what was it, Gomer used to say? 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Ron in South Carolina is on the line. Hey, Ron, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'd like to let you know I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
You were talking about corporations that had made huge profits and were receiving government money. Where can I find that piece of information?
That particular information I got from Americans Coming Together, ACT. I get it in an email from a guy named Jim Jordan. I'm not sure what their website is.
Americans Coming Together. Okay.
Yeah, okay. ActForVictory.org.
Acts for Victory.
ACTFORVICTORY.org.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Keep up the good work.
Thanks. I'll do my best.
Okay.
Good to hear from you, Ron. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 3 minutes before the hour. It's this is so much the point that has to be made. And again, we see this, you know, the G8 thing is coming up. And in the meeting of the G8 leaders. And they pledged to raise $20 billion to stop the spread of weapons of mass destruction. Only $17 billion has been ponied up. This was the last time around. And most of it hasn't been spent because they're all fighting about how it's going to be spent. The bottom line is, if we just wanted to clean up the nuclear stuff that's floating around the Soviet Union, which Al Gore was talking about, which John Kerry is talking about, which John McCain has been talking about, it would cost about $45 million. I'm sorry, it would cost about $30 billion. Rather significant difference. And we've only allocated, you know, the G8 have only allocated $20 billion for this. President Bush's last budget underfunded Nunn-Lugar. That's the program intended to keep the former Soviet Union's nuclear legacy out of the hands of terrorists and rogue states by about $45.5 million. That's where that number came from. In other words, at the time that George Bush is saying, be afraid, be very afraid, there are terrorists out there with nuclear weapons, he's cutting funding to the programs that will stop the proliferation of the known nuclear stockpiles around the world, many of which are like guarded by some old toothless guy and a dog in the middle of Kazakhstan. Incredible. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Transforming the World by Revitalizing Democracy.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back, and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide, and you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
Two big decisions handed down by the Supreme Court yesterday affecting pension policy and truck traffic. In the first case, two Illinois men who worked construction jobs and then retired at the age of 39 will have their pensions restored to their full amounts. The Central Laborers' Pension Fund docked them benefits after the two had gone back to work. The justices did leave the door open for pension funds to adopt restrictions against so-called double-dipping in the future, though, so long as the workers in the fund know about the policy when they join it. The second case clears the way for Mexican truck traffic to travel unimpeded on U.S. highways as required by the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. Various environmental and union groups had sued to block the move, citing clean air and vehicle safety concerns, but the Supreme Court said it's not the federal government's job to consider such factors when following free trade obligations.
Instead of passing an extension for unemployment benefits, a new bill approved by the House on Thursday seeks to set up so-called re-employment accounts. Unemployed workers could receive up to $3,000 in a personal account for use in getting a job. However, the exact amount will be up to each state to determine, and to be eligible, a person must be able to prove they are likely to exhaust their unemployment benefits.
Although independent trade unions are currently illegal in Iraq under the law of the occupying authorities, the Federation of Workers' Councils and Unions in Iraq continues to work on a draft labor law to be implemented following the planned restoration of sovereignty at the end of June. And it's setting its sights high: a maximum 6-hour working day or 30-hour work week, retirement at age 55, double pay for working nighttime hours, and a minimum 36 days of vacation per year are just some of the provisions in the draft legislation.
7,000 striking home health care workers in New York City declared a partial victory on Monday when their union, the Service Employees International Local 1199, reached a tentative new contract. Home health care workers' average pay is $7 per hour, but under the terms of the new agreement, their wages will increase to $10 per hour in the next 3 years. However, the tentative settlement only covers half of the total 23,000 striking health care workers throughout the city. The other half will remain on strike through Wednesday.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The nation's unemployment rate for May remained steady at 5.6%, even though there were a 250,000 new jobs generated last month, and the number of unemployed people counted by the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics actually rose by 39,000. The Economic Policy Institute qualifies this as a solid job market recovery, but notes it takes the average American looking for a job 5 months now to find success.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Have you visited 100fires.com lately? If not, then you're missing out on thousands of books for a better world. Books about how you can make a difference, about the rights of workers, creating more livable communities, and about how we can stop large corporations from destroying our democracy. 100fires.com offers secure ordering, full searchability, gift certificates, and much, much more. That's 100fires.com. Books for a better world.
Wow, that White House spin machine is in full twirl over the U.S. torture scandals in Iraq. Not to worry, those disgusting acts were just the work of a half dozen low-level grunts who should have known better. Where's the machine, now in nuclear-powered perpetual motion? No one in command, much less at the Pentagon or White House, had a clue that this was happening, and it's contrary to our official policy against any abuse of any prisoners, they spin. And look over there, the White House shrieks. We're prosecuting those bad soldiers to the hilt. So see, the system works, and that's the end of the story, so let's move on. But wait, Rumsfeld knew about the torture last year, and he personally told George W. about it in January. They not only had a clue, they had full detailed reports from the Army itself and from the Red Cross. Yet they kept it hush-hush, apparently not feeling disgust until the torture became public. As far as official policy is concerned, look at what has just surfaced. A series of 2001 and 2002 internal memos from Bush's Justice Department and from his top White House lawyer claiming that the U.S. did not have to comply with the Geneva Conventions and other international bans on prisoner abuse. White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez, who seems to think that his job amounts to finding a rationalization for anything the Bushites want to do, wrote in a 2002 memo to George that the war on terrorism, quote, in my judgment, renders obsolete Geneva's strict limitation on questioning of enemy prisoners. This is Jim Hightower saying, obsolete? Fashions can become obsolete. Machines get obsolete too, but fundamental morals and guidelines for humane conduct cannot, especially not on some partisan lawyer's whim. But there it is in writing, a policy sanctioning abuse and even torture written on White House stationery. It turns out that those grunts in Iraq were acting within a legal framework devised by the Bushites themselves.
I am Gunnery Sergeant Arlie Ermey, United States Marine Corps. While our armed forces defend our freedom, their families shoulder household duties and emergencies alone. To help, the veterans of foreign wars and Vermont American brand Bits and Blades have created the Unmet Needs Program.
Rufus Forrest here, VFW Senior Administrator. Please support the Unmet Needs Program by purchasing Vermont American Bits and Blades. A portion of each purchase goes to help families.
Visit unmetneeds.com and buy Vermont American brand Bits and Blades. Thank you and Semper Fi. Hoorah!
Hello from Athens, Greece. Leave it to Econo Lodge and Roadway Inn Hotels to create the Wake Up a Winner sweepstakes. Go to choicehotels.com to learn how to enter, and you can win a trip to the big events in Athens. To book, call 800-4-CHOICE or go to choicehotels.com. Choice Hotels. We'll see you there.
No purchase necessary. Open to legal U.S. residents 18 and older. Void where prohibited. Promotion runs June 7th through August 29th, 2004. For official rules and how to enter without purchase, visit choicehotels.com.
Calling for a wrap.
rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Donald Rumsfeld apparently beginning to get it that you can't declare war on ideas. Now think about that for a minute. Can you declare a war on an idea? You're going to kill off everybody who has the idea? What if other people get the idea? Kill them too? The United States and its allies, this is an article by Robert Burns, Dateline Singapore, in the Chicago Sun-Times. The United States and its allies are winning some battles in the terrorism war, but may be losing the broader struggle against Islamic extremism that is terrorism's source, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said Saturday. Yes! Hosni Mubarak of Egypt said to George W. Bush, if you invade Iraq, you know, without clear proof that Iraq is intending to attack nearby countries of the United States, if you invade Iraq, you're going to create 100 Osama bin Ladens. You can't attack an idea with guns. I'm sorry. That's why I say it's the whole idea of a war on terrorism. Terrorism is a tactic. We have to be honest about this. We either have a war against radical Islam, or we're going to try to kill everybody who uses non-conventional warfare techniques against us, which is terrorism. I mean, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't hold water. And Rumsfeld, I think, is starting to figure this out, at least according to this article. The troubling unknown, he said, is whether the extremists, what he called zealots and despots, bent on destroying the global system of nation-states, are turning out newly trained terrorists faster than the United States can capture or kill them. There you go. It's quite clear to me that we do not have a coherent approach to this, Rumsfeld said at an international security conference. Gee. Saturday, he went further, saying that while terrorists must be confronted, the bigger problem is the extremist Islamic ideology that produces them. And here, I mean, this is incredible. He said what I've been saying for a year now, which is that 9/11 was part of a civil war in Saudi Arabia. I mean, why do you think Osama bin Laden made sure that the majority of the hijackers were Saudis? If he didn't want to harm the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia, he could have changed. He had plenty of guys. Why is it that most of them were Saudis? This is a civil war in Saudi Arabia for the heart and soul of Saudi Arabia, the whole Wahhabism thing. This virulent, toxic, anti-Semitic, anti-Christian, anti-Buddhist and Hindu, anti-everybody form of Islam, which represents a very tiny minority of Islam around the world. A very tiny minority. And yet has been promoted. I mean, you know, the Saudi royal family got into bed with these guys back in the 50s when we brought them to power. And it's a tangled web. It's too complex to go through the whole explanation of it here. It would be, you know, you'd be falling asleep. But the bottom line is that this infectious idea has been originating in Saudi Arabia for the better part of 30 years. Osama bin Laden became a true believer in it. And based on that belief system, he concluded that Saudi Arabia itself was bad, was evil, was part of the evil empire. This is why in their in their rants, they never refer to it as Saudi Arabia. They call it the Saudi Peninsula. Or the Gulf, the peninsula in the Gulf. Because they don't recognize Saudi Arabia, which is named after the House of Saud, as legitimate. And here you and I've been saying for over a year, I wrote this piece in a book called From the Ashes, A Spiritual Response to 9/11 that was published 3 weeks after 9/11 in one of those instant books by Rodale. It's still in print. I contributed a chapter to it. The Pope contributed a chapter to it. Billy Graham sent it, put in a chapter. There were a bunch of them. The Dalai Lama. A few other people you haven't heard of as well. But it was a really good piece. And basically what I said is this is a war for the heart and soul of Islam. And if we respond with guns and bullets, we will further radicalize them and we will strengthen their hand. And they will say to all of their followers, see, I told you so. They really are out to get us. And we will breed more of what we are being harmed by. Whereas if we treat them, on the other hand, as psychopaths and criminals, and do everything we can to encourage moderate Islam around the world, this will be a very brief phase in the history of Islam. Just like Tim McVeigh blowing up the Oklahoma building, the Oklahoma Federal Building, a brief phase in the history of radical right-wing Christianity, the abortion doctor attacks, you know, on it goes, whatever. Let's take some calls. 1-866-889-8894 is our number. Brian in Cherry Hill, New Jersey is first on the line. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yesterday I was out doing some gardening work, and I had some kids, said they were from Alabama. They were selling magazines. I'm not sure if it was a scam or whatever, but like always, I got into a political conversation with them, and I asked them who they were voting for. And they said Bush, and I asked them why, and their reason was he had made some strong commitments to the country, and they had agreed with Iraq. Well, after about 10 or 15 minutes, I had them convinced otherwise, especially actually what you were just talking about. I told them we were creating more terrorists than stopping them, and they agreed with me. And so after the conversation, I asked them, so who are you going to vote for now? And they said, well, you know what? I don't think it matters who we vote for, because I think there's some bigger secret government that runs this government. And I honestly didn't know what to say to them. So what do you think? Do you think these conspiracy theorists like Alex Jones and David Icke, do you think they have any... validity to them, or how do they respond?
Well, you know, they do a good job of pointing out things that need to be pointed out from time to time. Ike's lost me. I went to a speech he gave a couple of years ago in Los Angeles, Louise and I did. And it was a two-hour presentation. The first hour was just this kind of very logical progression, starting with the Masons, you know, back in the 12th century, leading up to today. And then he gets to the how Bill Clinton was president at the time, how Bill Clinton gets up every morning and zips on his human suit because he's actually a lizard.
Right.
And at that point, I was astounded that there were so many people in the room who were just taking notes and I mean, it was, but is there a secret government? Sure, absolutely. And it's not a secret. It's not a secret. It is. I mean, they're right out there. They're the Bush pioneers and the Bush Rangers. They are the bundlers. They are the lobbyists. They are the corporations who have taken over so much of American media, so much of American, the American economy, and with a very few exceptions, to some extent, I'd say about the only people in the Republican Party who haven't been fully co-opted are Olympia Snowe, Voinovich, I forget his first name, George Voinovich, and possibly John McCain. And on the Democratic side, there's a good number. There's probably 15, 20, 30. Particularly in the House of Representatives, a number of idealists on the Democratic side. Then, of course, the independent Bernie Sanders, who have not bought into the secret government, as it were, who are not members of it. But yeah, we have a secret government in the United States. It's called the corporate aristocracy, in my opinion.
Right.
And now there are probably other groups as well. Skull and Bones is an old boy network. There's other old boy networks. There's a whole bunch of them out there, and that we have always had with us. You talk to people who have great money, great wealth, and generally you know, they didn't, they got it, as Jim Hightower would say, the old-fashioned way. They inherited it. Go to the right schools, make the right connections, you know, it's very rare, in fact. I remember back in the 80s when I was writing for Computer World and IDG, you know, a publishing company that did a bunch of computer magazines, and I was interviewing a lot of computer industry executives, including a lot of these, you know, so-called entrepreneurs, these people who had built these businesses out in Silicon Valley and become multimillionaires. And almost without exception, they had come from wealthy families and gone to private schools. Almost without exception. Looking back on it, I can't think of one who had gone to public school. And so, you know, there is an old boy network in America, and you know, they look after themselves and all that sort of thing, and we have to acknowledge that.
How do we convince people that they're not, you know, controlling us, though?
Well, I mean, very straightforward stuff. For example, I mean, the contest we're running here. Name one piece of legislation that George Bush and the Republicans have put forward in 3.5 years that would primarily benefit humans rather than corporations.
Right.
That would primarily benefit democracy rather than making corporations richer. As a starting point, I mean, you know, he's just pointing out the truth, waking people up to what's going on is really the starting point. And, you know, it would be a nice thing for us to have some useful slogans. You know, Clinton lied, nobody died, for example. I think that's a bumper sticker that should be all over America, even though it takes a bit of a swipe at Clinton, nonetheless. It raises an issue that I think our press has completely forgotten about.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Completely forgotten about. So, you know, we need to do the thought virus thing. We need to be spreading ideas, you know, confronting nonsense when we see it, and being out there. Did you end up buying magazines from those guys, Brian?
No, but I think I might have changed their political thought process a little bit. So you helped me win the lawnmower awards, not the water cooler awards.
Okay, good on you. Thanks for calling, Brian. Good to hear from you. 18 minutes past the hour, 1-866-889-8894. Chuck in New Mexico is on the line. Hey, Chuck, what's up?
Hey there. Two things. Number one, I've read with extreme displeasure Bush's attempt to link what's going on in Iraq with D-Day.
Yeah, isn't that pathetic?
My father was in the 82nd Airborne Division going into St. Mary Glace, and I want to personally say that I find that offensive that he would do such a thing.
You know, I think a lot of people, certainly all over Europe, they found that offensive, and I think that a lot of people in the United States, particularly men and women of the age who remember the sacrifices of World War II, saw right through that.
Yeah. And I was the next generation. I was in the 173rd in Vietnam. And I think it's a whole lot more like Vietnam, to be perfectly honest.
Sure.
And I'll tell you one other thing. Vung Nhao Giap, who was the commander and chief of the North Vietnamese military, and he's still alive, and he made a comment about Iraq. And he said that any country that invades another country to no purpose loses moral ascendancy and will lose.
Yeah, it's a brilliant, brilliant. Chuck, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Well said. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do they know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
It is one of the most powerful books you'll ever read, full of the wisdom of ancient cultures and the directed hope of modern thinkers. The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late by Tom Hartman. Discover how we're made of sunlight and what this has to do with the impact of fossil fuels on civilization. Read about the coming new ice age and what must be done soon. Understand how ancient cultures valued community and cooperation and what we can learn from them. Get in touch with the secret of enough, the meaning of wealth, and the wealth of security. The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight helps us understand and heal our relationship to the world, to each other, and to our natural resources. We have much to learn and even more to remember. Here is your guide, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late by Tom Hartman, in bookstores everywhere.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. A new study in the Journal of Urban Economics found that city dwellers living close to a National Football League franchise pay higher rent and property taxes for that privilege. On average, a resident in an NFL city pays $184 a year, or 8% more than those without a football team. And researchers found total property taxes were about $50 million a year higher.
Hey, what does this word make you think of? Tchaikovsky.
Isn't it? So what's the word?
No, that is the word.
You lost.
All right, who's Martha Graham?
She invented the graham cracker. Before her, there was only soda crackers.
Maybe they're not getting enough art. Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Tchaikovsky's music and Martha Graham's dance. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Out of His Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's The Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
You're listening to The Tom Hartman Program.
Looking out my window here, I'm seeing a beautiful day here in the People's Republic of Vermont. They say it might even get up to 90, if you can imagine. Just a month ago, I had snow outside my window. In fact, last week, we had a hailstorm. We got about an inch of this white stuff. It was incredible. Anyhow, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from high up in the Green Mountains of the People's Republic. No stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction will be found in Iraq, and coalition leaders are wrong in their assessment of Saddam Hussein's arsenal, the former chief UN weapons inspector said Saturday. I'll tell you a little bit more about David Kaye's comments about Tony Blair and what he had to say in just a moment. We've got a couple of calls here. John in Akron, Ohio is on the line. Hey, John, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Great. What's up?
I'm one of those people, Tom, who really wanted to get to the bottom of the situation, so I looked up all this information as to why we were over in Iraq, and I think I inadvertently stumbled onto something that really scared the bejesus out of me.
What's that?
You probably heard of all the peak oil stuff,
mm-hmm.
and I'm reading about this. I think one of the sites, Life After the Oil Crash, you know, it's really, really scary. And so,
yeah, I've
been reading this stuff, and I'm like, you know, is there any hope for us? I mean, once this stuff runs out, I mean, I'm thinking society is just going to collapse in on itself because we're just so dependent on oil.
Well, society is going to go through some very wrenching changes in the next generation. There's no doubt about that. I wrote a book about this topic called The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. Sunlight, of course, being oil.
Mm-hmm.
And it was first published in 1996 or 97, and we just came out with a new and improved version of it that just came out like 4 months ago from Randomize.
Right.
And it's got all the stats in there and all the stuff, you know. And I was actually using oil industry stats rather than, you know, the Greenpeace kinds of things. Let's go with the most optimistic estimates. I mean, you know, the pessimists say, well, there's 10, 20 years left. The optimists say there's 30, 40 years left. In my mind, it doesn't make much difference. I mean, it's like, you know.
Right. And what are we going to do, though? Like, how do we...
Well, the reality is that the technology, the alternative technology, already exists, John.
Oh, okay.
This is the thing that most people don't get, is that photovoltaic cells are now financially competitive with the production of oil, both on a local basis, that is, if you, you know, cover the roof of your house with them, or... or on a local community basis, and many of the other technologies, wind technology. I mean, you know, Finland's getting into this big time. England's getting into this big time. British Petroleum is starting to run ads about the fact that they are now the largest solar supplier in the world.
I bet I saw some of those.
Yeah, everybody except the American oil companies are figuring it out, and the American oil companies are just going to suck this thing dry as long as they've got somebody in the White House who's stupid enough to not figure it out.
Guys. Wow. Well, at least there's hope over the horizon.
I think there is, and I think it's a transition that'll actually be a positive one. It's just a question of, you know, if we do it fast and sudden, it may be painful. If we start doing it gradually. And of course, this is what Jimmy Carter was all about. He was saying, you know, let's get started now. And if we had paid attention to him, if Reagan hadn't come in with all that money from the oil industry, it might be a very different world right now. We wouldn't be worrying about these things. John, thanks for the call. Let's move along to Roberta in New Mexico. Hey, Roberta, what's up?
Hey, thank you, Tom. Well, greetings from the high, sunny desert mesas where there are no cicadas.
Oh, thank you.
In New Mexico. This is an awesome program this morning. Your guest just blew me away. It occurred to me while I was listening that there are three personalities that the people can take on, that of reformer, that of revolutionary, or that of revelationary. This morning, the fearless search for truth is just mind-boggling.
We need to do all three, don't we?
And you're right, the secrecy is to be questioned, although a rival communicaster had on his program the other day, I was stunned to hear, named the names of the Bilderbergers now meeting in Switzerland, and named the names, and the fact also that Bush might be there in Europe, not just to see the Pope, but to visit with the Bilderbergers. So
the manipulations
and connivations to go on.
Yeah, it's an interesting theory, Roberta, and it's there's probably a lot of truth to it. Probably a lot of truth to it, that there's an international banking cartel that has always made money on war and peace, and that has a lot of influence on our government. I'm perfectly willing to believe that. 29 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here.
A must-read, The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. Ed Halliwell, a nationally recognized expert on ADD, said this about The Edison Gene.
Tom Hartman demonstrates that ADHD can be associated with creativity, high achievement, and a most successful adaptive style.
The Edison Gene, now available in bookstores everywhere.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
Two big decisions handed down by the Supreme Court yesterday affecting pension policy and truck traffic. In the first case, two Illinois men who worked construction jobs and then retired at the age of 39 will have their pensions restored to their full amounts. The Central Laborers Pension Fund docked them benefits after the two had gone back to work. The justices did leave the door open for pension funds to adopt restrictions against so-called double-dipping in the future, though, so long as the workers in the fund know about the policy when they join it. The second case clears the way for Mexican truck traffic to travel unimpeded on U.S. highways as required by the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. Various environmental and union groups had sued to block the move, citing clean air and vehicle safety concerns, but the Supreme Court said it's not the federal government's job to consider such factors when following free trade obligations.
Instead of passing an extension for unemployment benefits, a new bill approved by the House on Thursday seeks to set up so-called re-employment accounts. Unemployed workers could receive up to $3,000 in a personal account for use in getting a job. However, the exact amount will be up to each state to determine, and to be eligible, a person must be able to prove they are likely to exhaust their unemployment benefits.
Although independent trade unions are currently illegal in Iraq under the law of the occupying authorities, the Federation of Workers' Councils and Unions in Iraq continues to work on a draft labor law to be implemented following the planned restoration of sovereignty at the end of June. And it's setting its sights high, a maximum 6-hour working day or 30-hour work week, retirement at age 55, double pay for working nighttime hours, and a minimum 36 days of vacation per year are just some of the provisions in the draft legislation.
10,000 striking home health care workers in New York City declared a partial victory on Monday when their union, the Service Employees International Local 1199, reached a tentative new contract. Home health care workers' average pay is $7 per hour, but under the terms of the new agreement, their wages will increase to $10 per hour in the next 3 years. However, the tentative settlement only covers half of the total 23,000 striking health care workers throughout the city. The other half will remain on strike through Wednesday.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The nation's unemployment rate for May remained steady at 5.6%, even though there were a 250,000 new jobs generated last month, and the number of unemployed people counted by the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics actually rose by 39,000. The Economic Policy Institute qualifies this as a solid job market recovery, but notes it takes the average American looking for a job 5 months now to find success.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 26 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. As John from, I believe it was Akron, Ohio, pointed out, here's Dick Cheney on why it was so important to invade Iraq.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, and Bush's his thoughts on restoring chaos to Iraq.
You're free, and freedom is beautiful. And, it'll take time to restore chaos and order, but we will.
But we will restore chaos. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Here we go. This
springtime for Hitler and Germany.
Yes. This is going to be the theme song for the RNC convention in New York. Of course, it's a Broadway play now. Yes. Good old Mel Brooks, Springtime for Hitler. Oh. Yeah, here comes the Master Race. And by the way, this is where I part company, by the way. Roberta, thank you for your call and your comment about the Bilderbergers. There's no doubt in my mind that for many, many, many years, many centuries, that there have been wealthy families that have, if not controlled, had a huge degree of influence over the course of world affairs and world events and various governments in various ways. I mean, it's just, money is power. Where I part company with many of the conspiracy theorists on this is that on the right, and this was the basis, basically, of Hitler's doctrine. But even today, in the American right, there is this belief that that conspiracy, that those bankers and all, is a Jewish conspiracy. I'm sorry. This isn't about Jews or Christians or Catholic. I mean, you want the Catholic conspiracies? You know, read about the Knights Templar. Go to KnightsTemplar.com. Everybody's got a conspiracy theory on these things. I'm willing to absolutely believe that money has power. But when it gets into this stuff, which it so often gets into, particularly with people on the right, but also with people on the left. That this is, that there's some sort of worldwide Jewish conspiracy. You know, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion were forgery. They were forged by Tsar Nicholas. And it's just, so I just want to be sure that I'm on record saying that. And not out of, I'm afraid that the conspirators are going to come after me. No, because I really think that this is true. I mean, this is just... Anyway, here's David Kaye. You'll recall David Kaye, who, he was the... I don't know if you know the history of this. We had Scott Ritter on the program a year ago when David Kaye was first assigned to go off to Iraq. And David Kaye used to work for Scott Ritter on the weapons inspection program. And one of the problems that Scott Ritter had was that while he was in Iraq with David Kaye back in the 90s, 96, 97, 98, looking for weapons of mass destruction, it became apparent both to Scott Ritter and to the Iraqis that David Kaye was working for the CIA and that his main job wasn't to look for weapons, it was to gather intelligence. And the Iraqis became very upset about this and they started, reacting to it somewhat. And Ritter became upset about it because he felt that his mission was being compromised. He was working, after all, not for the United States government, but for the United Nations. This was a United Nations weapons inspection group. And so when David Kaye got trotted out by the Bush administration as the guy who was going to, fix everything. He's going to go over there. He's going to find the weapons of mass destruction. The first thought in my mind was, he'll find them as soon as FedEx gets there. And I have to tell you, I was astounded. I was astounded. As I think probably Scott Ritter was. I can't speak for him, and I haven't discussed this with him since then, but certainly many of us who had some inkling, had some knowledge of David Kaye's background, that this guy, he was a spook, and he was a loyal Republican, and, he was whatever you call conservative. I don't know if he's fiscal, social, whatever he is, but, he was in the Bush camp. He was one of their guys. And, going back to Bush Sr. when he was head of the CIA. And here's this guy, David Kaye, who made a really, really serious effort. He took the better part of a year, nearly a year, with a large team and tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, and they searched every nook and cranny they could of this country. They got all the intelligence they could. We caught a bunch of the people who were high up in Saddam's regime and shipped them off to countries where they interrogate people by drilling their teeth with electric drills, sent them off to Saudi Arabia and Egypt for special treatment. And David Kaye ended up saying no. So now here comes Tony Blair again. Poor Tony Blair. It's like in England they refer to him as George Bush's poodle. And I'm increasingly seeing him as a tragic figure. I doubt that he knows it, but we have a friend in common. A friend of mine about two or three times a year has dinner with him. And has told me a few stories that give me some insight into his personality. And number one, I want to say, Tony Blair is a brilliant man. Top of his class, Christ Church College, Oxford University. He has the potential. He had the potential to be one of the best prime ministers of England. But he blew it. First of all, He went along with Bill Clinton's New Democrat thing. I mean, he had an opportunity to break cleanly with Margaret Thatcher's Reaganism. Thatcher and Reagan were this toxic duo that were hell-bent for leather on bringing corporatism to the United States, the United Kingdom, and ultimately the entire world. And Blair could have, I mean, he was elected, essentially, to the Labor Party. He was elected, or he was appointed by his party. His party won the majority in Parliament and appointed him. On the platform, on issues that would be friendly to labor and to, you know, to creating and building and strengthening a middle class in the United Kingdom. But I think he has this personality defect of you know, it's funny. I have some very good friends in England. I get over there regularly. One of my business partners for the last 17 years has been British. Still is. A very dear and close friend of mine. He and his family come over here regularly. We go over there. We ran forums on CompuServe and did other stuff on the internet for years and years and years. Actually, back when they paid you to do that kind of thing. And you know, and I speak at a lot of conferences in England, and you know, I just know a lot of Brits, and the thing that has really stood out to me is that, now I have to say, of my friend, the business partner, just in case he's listening, I don't really think he falls into either of these two categories, because he's not real neurotic about being British or my being American. But there is a category of folks, and it's probably true of every country in the world, who either, and I think in both cases this is out of insecurity, who either subscribe to a hyper-nationalism. Well, our country is so much better than your country. Your country is just, you know, toad poop. I mean, it's just, you don't know what you're doing. Or they subscribe to a form of national, well, I wouldn't use the Freudian term. Well, actually, you could, you know, the Freudian term penis envy. It's sort of a, you know, they have, geez, you guys have bigger weapons than we do. You have bigger missiles than we do. You have a bigger economy than we do. And I really think that Tony Blair is in that second category. And that he so desperately wanted to be liked by Bill Clinton that he adopted many of Clinton's New Democrat conservative economic policies, which have harmed England terribly and have harmed the United States terribly. And that when George Bush came along, Bush, people say, well, you know, Bush is an idiot, blah, 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 blah. And yes, intellectually, I'll agree with you. But people have different kinds of intelligence. You know, some people have great physical intelligence. Some people have, you know, they're very skillful at sports, for example. Some people have great mathematical intelligence. Some people have great musical intelligence. Howard Gardner brought us this concept in his book, The Seven Intelligences. And it's been since now expanded to 12, and people argue that there's 20. And one of those intelligences that Gardner identified was what he called interpersonal intelligence, the ability to make people like you in person. Now, Bush doesn't do this particularly well beyond one-on-one. Anybody who's seen one of his speeches or his press conferences, you know, this guy comes across as Alfred E. Newman on Ritalin. You know. But you talk to the people who know him and who have met him, and I've talked to several people who know him and have met him, and or you can hear, listen to Paul Begala sometime on Crossfire. Here's the guy who worked in the Clinton White House. He's as Democratic as they come. He's quite liberal. He is, I would say, kind of a conservative liberal in that he subscribes to the Democratic Leadership Council's, you know, New Democrat nonsense, but nonetheless, he's about as good as they come in national television. And Paul Begala, at least once a month, takes the opportunity of saying that, you know, he's met George Bush and he considers him a really fine man, a decent person, and a great guy to be around. Now, I have, you know, and I'm telling you, I've heard that from four people now who have met George Bush personally and spent time with him. And I can't get, you know, I don't get it. I mean, standing out here on the outside, I would think, you know, who would want, in their right mind, would want to spend time with this guy? But anyhow, I think that Bush has that interpersonal intelligence. And that he used it, he certainly used it to charm Colin Powell into betraying his own conscience and lying to his nation and world. He certainly used it to get Jon Snow, the previous one, I'm forgetting his name, the previous Secretary of the Treasury, who resigned and wrote the book, the tell-all book. He certainly used it to bring so many people in and around him, and used it very effectively as governor of Texas. And I really think that, you know, Tony Blair just desperately, you know, that there's that kind of America envy, that's kind of the subtext to it. But the larger text is that he desperately wants to be liked or even loved by the leader of the free world, the United States. I can come up with no other explanation. And so here we have Tony Blair a couple days ago. It was Friday. I don't know if it was a news conference or what it was. Anyhow, he says, "We know Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. He used them. What we know also is that we haven't found them yet." And then he pointed out, this is from the Associated Press, then he pointed out that the Iraq survey group was due to report in a few months. In other words, you know, give us a few more months. Here's Tony Blair. He's still echoing the lies and lines of Dick Cheney and George Bush, and they've stopped using them. I mean, you know, talk about poodle. So what does David Kay say to this? To bring us back to David Kay, where I started with this whole thing. And David Kay was rather outspoken. Of course, he resigned from the CIA in January on this thing. He says, "Anyone out there holding, as I gather Prime Minister Blair has recently said, the prospect that ISG, the International Survey Group, is going to unmask actual weapons of mass destruction are really delusional." Now, David Kay not only said this, he said it on BBC. He said, "There's nothing there. There's a program there. There was an intention of Saddam Hussein at some point to reconstitute it. There were clearly illegal activities, clear violations of UN Security Council resolutions, but there are no actual stockpiles of newly produced weapons of mass destruction." He said, "The problem," and I'm still quoting from David Kay, "the problem is the unwillingness to take the responsibility of saying a few simple words, we were wrong. We simply got it wrong. There actually are no weapons of mass destruction." David Kay speaking to Tony Blair. Isn't it fascinating? Here's another Bush mislead. This is the most recent one. Bush on January 6th, of course, said, they asked him, didn't you bring Ahmed Chalabi into this? Didn't you know him? Wasn't he one of your buddies, your neocon? I haven't had any extensive conversations with Chalabi. I don't remember anybody walking into my office and saying, Chalabi says this is the way it's going to be in Iraq. Fact. This is from David Sirota at the Center for American Progress. Fact. George Bush, this is a quote from George Bush, 11-27-03, November 27th, 03. "I did see Chalabi. I shook a lot of hands, saw a lot of kids, took a lot of pictures, served a lot of food, and we moved on to see four members of the governing council. The names are here. Talabani was the head of it right now, and so was the main spokesman, but Chalabi was there. We were there for maybe a little less than 30 minutes. Oh, no, I never met him. Yes, I met him. I don't know who he is. Yes, I spent a half hour with him." Does this qualify as a flip-flop or a lie? I'll leave it up to you. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, live coast to coast. We'll be right back.
Are you frustrated by your constant inability to lose weight? Are you looking for a natural, clinically proven weight loss breakthrough? Introducing CarboBlocker. Unlike anything else on the market, CarboBlocker is backed by clinical research that proves it effectively helps block the fattening effects of carbs without stimulants. Your body will think you're eating a low-carb diet even when you're not. The results are simply amazing. If you want to maintain the weight loss effects of low-carb dieting for the long run, if you're tired of clothes that are too tight and you want to look fit and sexy, then CarboBlocker is for you. It's clinically effective formula is safe, natural, and stimulant-free. And as a special introductory offer, when you order two bottles of Carbo Blocker, you'll get two bottles of Appetite Blocker absolutely free. Call in the next 10 minutes, and you'll also receive two free books, Lose Fat Now and the Low Carb Cookbook, a $100 value. Absolutely free, so call now, 1-800-743-5704. Guaranteed to work or your money back, so call now, 1-800-743-5704. That's 1-800-743-5704.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman.
Are you or a loved one making too many trips to the bathroom? Listen closely because you're not alone. Over 30 million men suffer from an enlarged prostate. That's why if you make frequent trips to the bathroom, have urgency, hesitancy, or a diminished sex drive, then Super Prostate Formula is for you. It was designed by nationally recognized physician Dr. Michael Toplitsky. The results with his patients have been amazing. Reclaim control now and join the thousands of satisfied customers who have had incredible results with Super Prostate Formula. When you order two bottles of Dr. Toplitsky's Super Prostate Formula, you'll also get two bottles of his Super Libido Formula, an all-natural alternative to Viagra to enhance sexual vitality and performance, plus his book, Complete Guide to Prostate Health, and his newsletter, a total $100 value free as your gift. Guaranteed or your money back. If you're not completely satisfied, return it for a full refund and keep his Libido Formula book and newsletter free as your gift. Not available in stores. Call now. 800-452-0978. 800-452-0978. That's 800-452-0978.
Shifting to renewable energy could create more than a million high-paying jobs. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. 13 separate studies have recently looked at the potential impact of renewable energy development on the U.S. economy. They vary in their methods and focus, but all agree on one thing. Solar, wind, biomass, and other renewable technologies could create a lot of new jobs. Daniel Kamen is an energy expert at the University of California at Berkeley. He recently evaluated those 13 studies.
The low-end estimates are that there would be maybe 500,000 new jobs by doing this. And the high-end estimates are a couple million new jobs.
Kamen's own assessment falls right in the middle. 1.2 million new jobs if we meet 20% of our future energy needs with renewable energy and efficiency programs.
And that's job growth above and beyond what you would get if you simply met that new 20% of energy mix from more fossil fuels. So this really is talking about job growth, not just sort of job substitution or replacement.
And they'd be good jobs, according to Kamen.
These are high-tech manufacturing-type jobs. These are what most economists consider to be high-quality jobs, both in terms of wages and in terms of career paths, and also jobs that are really productive for the economy.
Kamen says most of those jobs could not be outsourced to other countries, and he says a boost in biomass fuels would strengthen the American farm economy. But Kamen says this won't happen by itself. He says we need a major revision of national energy policy to provide rewards and incentives for renewable energy and efficiency. And he says we're missing an opportunity to cut our dependence on foreign oil and put a lot of people back to work. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Show a little passion, baby. Show a little style. Show them I can know when
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Integrity and passion in broadcasting truth. 4 minutes before the hour, the third hour of our program. Did you realize that our tax dollars are buying gasoline at $1.50 to $2 a gallon in Kuwait and shipping it to Iraq, and it is being sold to the Iraqi people at the gas pumps for 5 cents a gallon? 5 cents a gallon? Talk about subsidies, benefits, profits. Incredible. Tim and Santa. Oh, Tim, you vanished. Okay, well, here. Filling a 22-gallon tank in Baghdad with a low-grade fuel costs just $1.10. That's to fill the entire tank plus a 50-cent tip for the attendant. Tank full of high test costs $2.75. Although Iraq is a major petroleum producer, the Associated Press notes, the country has little capacity to refine its own gasoline, so the U.S. government pays about $1.50 a gallon to buy fuel in neighboring countries and deliver it to Iraqi stations. The U.S. government paid even more last year for Iraqi gasoline, up to $1.70 a gallon, when the imports were contracted to Halliburton. Now we took that away from them, and we're paying less. And gee, Dick Cheney's stock options are getting worth less, and his paychecks are probably not going to be quite as big. But anyhow, the Iraqis are moving right along. They're having this wonderful thing. Did you notice, by the way, that the raid on Ahmed Chalabi's home in Baghdad? He says they're out to get me, right? That this is part of a conspiracy. That the raid on his office was supposed to have been done exclusively by Iraqi police. There were actually four, they call them civilian contractors. Let's call them what they are. The private armies. You know, I mean, it's a private army. Reston-based Dynacorp. Four people from Reston-based Dynacorp International were present during the Iraqi police raid on the home and offices of former exile leader Ahmed Chalabi. Officials of Chalabi's Iraqi National Congress said that Americans in civilian clothes holding rifles and wearing body armor directed the Iraqi police on what rooms to go into and what items to take. Why do we have a private corporation over there attacking a member of the governing council? I mean, this is just, it is out of control. We got to change things in November, my friends. This is Tom Hartman. Thanks, Louise, for producing our program today. Thanks to Adam for engineering it. Thanks to Brad Walrod for our Adam Cohen. Thanks to Brad Walrod for our music. Thanks to Shelby for streaming us on radiopower.org and our sponsors, particularly Small Dog Electronics, who's stuck with us all this time. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up. Thanks to you for listening. See you tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
How can contemporary America possibly compare with 1933 Germany? Find out in Tom Hartman's brand new fully illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America. Through Tom's concise political analysis and Neil Cohn's vibrant illustrations, you'll observe an unsettling, if not shocking, perspective of America. You'll also hear what the founders of this country did to control corporate power. You'll be invited to consider how the American political system can be made more democratic, as well as comprehend the project for the new American century's vision for America.